Morning, Ann. Welcome to the June 6, 2022 meeting of the Chelan County Public Utility District Commission. And hopefully this is our last COVID-related virtual meeting. So we will be attending in person at our next meeting on June 20th. Do I have that right, everyone?
That's correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So we'll shoot for that. And in retrospect, looking back over the last couple of years, I just want to thank everyone for your patience and your work and dedication. And we've learned a lot with telecommunications and meetings over Zoom and Teams. But I'm looking forward to getting back in person, and we'll look forward to that. So. I'd like to thank everyone today for participating and remind you to please mute your screens and any electronic devices that you have with you today if you are unmuted with your screen. Today's meeting is a study and business session with a study session starting this morning at 10 a.m. and the afternoon business session starting at 1 p.m. We welcome the public's input at our meetings and remind you that these meetings are recorded. If you wish to address any item on the agenda, please raise your hand either physically or electronically on your screen that you wish to speak. When recognized, please state your name and address for the record and limit your comments to 3 minutes. Today we have all five commissioners present, Manager Kirk Hudson, General Counsel Eric Wahlquist, and Administrative Assistant Rebecca Newman. At this time, I'd like you to join with John Hale in leading the Pledge of Allegiance and the Safety Minute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Oh, good morning. My name is John Yale. I'm a principal electrical engineer with the Generation Group. Today I'm going to talk about something that we probably all have in our homes, and that's ladders. Ladders and ladder safety. So since I'm an engineer, we get to start out with some statistics here. If we can get it to click. There we go. So according to the WHO, falls are a leading cause of injury and death for all of us. The American Ladder Institute tells us 130,000 people visit the emergency room each year for ladder-related injuries, and there's 300 ladder-related deaths per year. CDC says 43% of fatal falls involve a ladder. And lastly, falls are the leading cause of death in and around the home. So since you have a ladder in your home, there's your chances. We do need to pay attention, but these are just statistics. How about real cases? At a SIATI meeting this spring, the Corps of Engineers presented the safety minute, and it regarded a fatality at one of their plants. A simple accident that cost somebody their life. The employee was on an 8-foot ladder attempting to take a picture with their phone of a data plate on a lightning arrestor. A simple task in a fairly simple place. The ladder tipped over and the employee fell approximately 5 feet onto a concrete footing. The employee was treated on site, evacuated to the hospital, and later pronounced dead. The truth was, the employee was not found until an operator decided to go outside and have their lunch. The people on site are agonized over what if they'd gotten to them sooner. So looking at ladder safety, there's 5 rules that I found from the Alliance Safety Council. They are: pick the right ladder for the job, inspect it before you use it, set up the ladder with care, climb and descend ladders cautiously, and above all, use common sense. Now, interestingly, at the same meeting where the Corps presented the report on the fatality, I was recommended a book to read. It's called The Checklist Manifesto. It's about how to get things right. It's by Atal Gawande. Basically, it's his journey in developing a pre-surgery checklist. He's a surgeon in Boston and was working for the WHO to reduce surgery accidents. It's a really good read with lots of tales of good and bad checklists. However, it does paint a compelling case that checklists, like the ones pilots use, are useful. He points out that we make two kinds of mistakes. First, there's mistakes of ignorance. We don't know enough. We didn't know not to do it, or we should have done it. And the second is there's mistakes of ineptitude. Mistakes because we don't apply what we know. We knew it, but we didn't apply it. Checklists are designed to improve outcomes, to address those mistakes of ineptitude. They don't tell you what to do, but they help you to be as smart as possible. So he points out that good checklists are precise, they're efficient, they're reminders of the critical steps that need to be done, but above all, they're practical. If they're not used, they don't make any difference. So what if we had a ladder checklist before we get on one? Well, I went and Googled that, and this is the first one I found. It's from OSHA, and it's pretty useful, but it does have some issues, and Atoll points out for bad checklist. First, there's too many details. There's 17 items on here. Are you really reading them all? Are you going to read them all before you put the topper on your Christmas tree this year? It also tells us what to do rather than reminding us of the things we know how to do. So what if we apply his principles to come up with a quick reminder type checklist, one that could be used, one for ladders? So this is my before you climb a ladder checklist. It's probably not perfect, but I tried to come up with something that's useful quick, something that I could run through before I get on that ladder. First, do you have the correct type of ladder? Do you use a step ladder where you should be using an extension ladder, or do you need something else? Is it in good condition? Do you really want to trust it with your life? You want to make sure it's secure, has stable footing, but it's tall enough for what you want to do, you know, the third step rule. You want to set it up properly positioned, set it up so you can avoid overreaching, and lastly, to remember the problem at the core, tell somebody what you're doing so they can look out for you. Above all, be safe.
Great. John, Gary?
John, I just want to tell you that this topic is spot on, and the timing is, couldn't be any better. I personally have a 6-foot step ladder that I probably should have thrown away 30 years ago. And it to say it's on its last leg doesn't accurately describe the condition of this ladder. It's in really bad shape. And after seeing the statistics that you put on the board and countless times nearly falling over on this ladder, I am encouraged to finally get rid of it. So thanks, John. Appreciate that.
Turn it into garden art.
Anne?
Yeah, I have a comment too, John. That was terrific. Really, really good. I just wanted to share my instructor for when I was getting my private pilot's license. When I started with him, he had 25,000 flying hours. He had been a commercial pilot, I think for Continental. Anyway, he lost his life in a flying accident, and we're pretty certain that he did not look at his checklist, and that's happened with other pilots. But if you you've heard the saying, there's old pilots, there's bold pilots, but there's no old pilots. And I'm telling you, the pilots, when you're flying a plane, you could have had 30,000 hours, and you look at that checklist every single time. So, yeah, checklists are critical. Thanks. Great words of wisdom.
Thank you, John. Appreciate your time and the message.
Have a great day.
All right. So let's, at this point, no resolutions have been recommended for the consent agenda from staff. For the public's information, items on the consent agenda are subject to transfer to the regular agenda. upon the request of any commission member. Do I hear any such request or additions to the agenda? Okay, the agenda stands. So Kirk, let's go ahead and go on to item number three, customer satisfaction survey results.
Thank you, Commissioner McKenna. Yeah, we have a guest today that's from Strategies 360 that was helping us do the customer satisfaction survey, and this is something we try to do every couple of years. It's very important to us, as customer satisfaction is on the top of our balanced scorecard and a key function of us being a public utility. So just appreciate the help with Strategies 360 and appreciate all the customers that participated in the survey. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Alex Dunn to help share the results here.
Okay, thanks so much. And it's a pleasure to be with you all today. Many of you will probably recall we had a quick conversation about 6 weeks ago, maybe 2 months, where we talked about unrolling the satisfaction survey this year and how that would be conducted, and getting feedback from our residential customers in Chelan County. So we successfully did that. And if we could look at slide three, Rebecca, thank you. You can get a sense for how we did this. It's very similar to how we've collected this data in years past. But we're happy to say that this year we achieved more completed interviews across the county than Chelan PUD has at any point in the past, speaking to 600 residential ratepayers. And we spent about a week gathering those responses across a number of different methods, which we think were key to getting the level of representativeness that we achieved. We allowed customers to take the survey either via phone on landlines or mobile phones, or online via email invitations and also text message invitations. What that means for you when you see this data is that there is an overall margin of error to keep in mind of about plus or minus 4%. And that margin of error does climb when we talk about smaller subgroups of people. So I want to just give you a quick overview of the data so you have a sense of where customers are at. And then we'll leave a few minutes for questions at the end. Of course, if you have any questions as I'm running through, please let me know. I think we can go ahead and skip to slide seven, which is a review of how this data looks. Like I mentioned, this is representative of the county based on the best metrics that we have, which tends to be the U.S. Census. So we reached a wide range of customers by gender, age, race, those who have been in the county longer versus shorter periods of time, and of course, in more concentrated urban areas versus more dispersed folks out in the further reaches of the county. And on the next slide, you can see that there's something a little bit different about this year, which is in light of the 2 years of the pandemic, you'll recall that the last survey that we conducted was right at the outset of COVID. We've added a couple of questions that are standard across many of our surveys for similar clients, Chelan PUD, and one of them is just checking in on our respondents' financial circumstances, because we found that to be key in the ways in which they interact with their utility, the way that they feel about government agencies, and just their own livelihoods in general. So what you can take away from this, and this will come up a little bit later in the presentation, is that less than half of folks in Chelan County say that they can live comfortably while also saving an adequate amount for the future. About the same number say either that they can get by every month but struggle to save money or pay for unexpected expenses, or that they find it difficult to make ends meet every month. It's just a new normal that, of course, doesn't owe just to COVID, but also inflation and the rising cost of housing and gas and groceries things that do have an impact on their relationship with the utility as well as their livelihood in general. So just something to keep in the back of your mind as we go through these numbers. Let's go ahead and skip to slide 10. This is the first question we ask, and it is overall satisfaction with Chelan PUD on a scale from 1 to 5. 5 is very satisfied, and 1 is very unsatisfied. And you can see these numbers look pretty familiar compared to previous years, which is to say that your customers are giving you a very strong vote of confidence, despite 2 years of a pretty tumultuous set of economic hardships that many folks have endured, and the fact that they've had a different relationship with the utility, with its doors closed in terms of customer service, at least on site, interacting in different ways with the PUD, and all the things that come along with that, satisfaction remains very high. So 2/3 give the utility a 5 score of very satisfied, another 1/4 give it a 4. The other thing to look at here is the folks who offer a score of 1 or 2. In other words, dissatisfied is just under, right at about or under 5%. So this is pretty consistent with previous years, as you can see on the next slide. That number is actually up slightly compared to 2020, at which point the overall satisfaction score, in other words, those who say either a 4 or a 5 on that scale of 1 to 5, was at 86%. Of course, the margin of error does mean that that 89% is within that plus or minus 4% in terms of change.
Question.
But to the, yeah. Uh-huh.
On this particular slide, I'm noting 20 and 22, not a huge drop, but it was a drop. And it also coincided with the COVID time period. Is, in other surveys that you're taking, have you seen corresponding dips in this same time period?
Yes, is the short answer. It really varies depending on the particular communities that we're surveying. And, every community is different. But COVID introduced an entirely new range of variables. For a lot of people, it meant that their interactions with the public agencies that they had a relationship with changed in a material way. For many, it meant that they just couldn't afford their bills in the same way that they had before. And that always manifests itself in some change to their level of satisfaction with that agency. So did this surprise us? Not necessarily. There's one other thing that I should point out, which is that Strategies 360 has been conducting these surveys just since 2020. So we can't speak as much to the data prior to 2020, just because it wasn't us that was collecting it. But what we can say is that since 2020, that data has been as robust and representative as it has at any point in the past. I do think, Commissioner, to your point, that the changes in the overall environment and landscape and the pandemic itself are probably the biggest things we could point to if we had to make educated guesses about that change.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think I remember when the 2018 survey was presented, it was presented with a little bit of the idea that this was kind of an anomaly, and don't expect 97% to occur again. That's a really unusual number. Not quite sure how it got there, but the admonition was don't marry this number, because it's not going to hold. So I just think that, bit of caution was there. I think the other thing that might have affected, some of the results this year is it was Snowmageddon that we had. A number of people were unable to get their meters read. Their bills were averaged. Some of the adjustments were higher than anticipated. Fixed incomes, limited budgets. And they were frustrated that some of their payments weren't adequate and what they had budgeted for and those kinds of things. And our staff did a great job of working, you know, with those individuals. But it was, I got more calls and contacts related to that than I have in the, you know, the previous 15 years. And it was just, they were saddened that they were not able to meet their public utility obligation as the same way that they always had. So there might have been a little bit of that. But anyway, so those are just two comments.
Yeah, thank you. And I think we've seen that in other places as well, where it feels like the bar has shifted a little bit since 2020, where a lot of agencies and PUDs in particular are just trying to keep things at pre-2020 levels while there's been all of this intense period of change, and where folks just are sort of uprooted in the ways in which they're used to communicating with the PUD, to paying their bills. So I definitely think that is a relevant point. On the next slide, we can start to shed some light on some of the groups that feel especially either positive or maybe a little bit less positive that contributes to that overall number. And I should just say before we start here that when you have an overall satisfaction score of 89%, that means that there really are no groups in the county of any meaningful size that have a particularly negative view of the utility. So this is really just parsing out some of the somewhat minor differences in overall satisfaction, but there are still some among different groups. What we see is that looking at those folks who give the utility a score of a 5, in other words, very satisfied, there's a little bit of an uptick and a sort of higher propensity to be satisfied, especially in the more rural parts of the county and also among older residential customers. On the next slide, you can see there are a couple of key differences that are explained by personal finances and bill size. And this tends to be the primary driving factor behind any differences in satisfaction this year. In other words, if you describe yourself and your family and your household as being able to live comfortably and save, which again is about 45% of the county, you're the most likely to express a very satisfied relationship with the utility. 69% of those folks say they're very satisfied. That is also largely true of those in the middle category who say they're getting by but struggling to save. 61% are very satisfied. But for those who say that they are finding it difficult just to make ends meet on a monthly basis, that intensity of satisfaction drops to 46%. And their overall satisfaction drops to 74. That doesn't mean that there's a large chunk of these folks that are dissatisfied, but it does mean that they are less likely to express that same level of intensity and to say that they're very satisfied with Chelan PUD. There are a few more folks on the negative side and a few more in that kind of neutral territory that give the PUD a 3. There is also a relationship between average monthly bill size and satisfaction. It's not quite as strong, but suffice to say that if your household is paying a little bit less, in other words, less than $75 a month, your satisfaction tends to be a bit higher. If you're paying a little bit more, in other words, more than $75 a month, your satisfaction tends to still be high, but a little bit depressed compared to those lower average bill size folks. On the next slide, there are a couple more things worth pointing out, although these are not as strong in their predictive power over satisfaction. The first is the length of time you've spent in the county. For folks who have been in Chelan PUD, living there physically for less than 5 years, there is a propensity to offer even higher scores. Now, whether that's because of the contrast between Chelan PUD services and communications and bill size compared to where they came from, or just for other reasons entirely, those folks are especially pleased with their relationship with the PUD and the PUD's performance. The same is true of folks who have been in the county for a long time. but we just wanted to note that it's especially high among that that newer group to the county. Whether or not you're a full or part-time resident does not have a lot of impact on your satisfaction, but there is a slightly higher rate of satisfaction among homeowners as compared to renters.
Alex, I have a question here.
Sure.
Is there any correlation between renters and over $75 monthly bills? I didn't see that in any of your data, but can you draw a correlation that if you're a renter and your monthly bill's over $75, and the reason I'm bringing that up is that as a commission, we've addressed that, or we've tried to address that, and perhaps we need to look at it again.
Yeah, thanks, Commissioner. So I can look into that. The sample size will get pretty small because renters only make up a small portion of the county, and then to also look at them by their average bill size. But that's something that I can try to look at in the data. If the sample size is big enough, I can get back to you on that question. But I think it's probably fair to say, given that those two groups both express slightly lower levels of overall satisfaction, and I think also renters tend to be more likely to say that they're having a hard time making ends meet as compared to folks who are homeowners. Now, that's not universally true, but I think the tendency is in that direction. So I think for those couple of reasons, that's likely to be true.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay, let's go ahead and move on. So we also follow up, as we have in years past, with an opportunity for the folks who are being interviewed to give us a description in their own words of why they either felt positively or negatively about the performance of the PUD. So on this slide, it's just those folks who gave a 4 or 5 score to the utility. What we did is we took those open-ended responses and we categorized them. So there's a long, long list of actual verbatim quotes that are available if you want to take a look at those. But for the purposes of time, what it mainly breaks down into is a plurality of these satisfied customers point to good rates or customer service or reliable service. So those three kind of top factors make up the bulk of these folks. There's also some praise for responsiveness among PUD staff, and then some kind of second tier praise along the lines of parks and community, environmental impacts and policies, etc. On the next slide, you'll see
the questions.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's a question or a comment. I'm really surprised that our fiber doesn't rank higher than 1%. In customer satisfaction survey, in terms of people even being aware that it's our fiber?
I could really only speculate, I think. We have found in other neighboring, so if you take Grant PUD, for example, who is another customer of ours, we found in focus groups there that a lot of their customers, to your point, don't necessarily associate the fiber with the PUD. They associate it more closely with the service provider. I don't know exactly what the model is in Chelan PUD, but I suspect that that could be one of the reasons. Or it could just be, you know, when folks think about the number one reason that they're pleased with the PUD, it could be the rates or the responsiveness that come to mind before the fiber. So I could really only speculate, but those could be two possible reasons.
Thank you.
On the next slide, you'll see a smattering of negative responses. So there are a handful of folks who have some concerns or complaints with the PUD. And those don't really, I mean, the majority of them do fall into the perceived category of rate increases. There's always folks, regardless of where we survey and whether or not rates have increased, that feel like rates have gone up. Now, whether or not that's the case in Chelan County or whether how recent they are is sort of beside the point, right? Especially in a world in which customers have experienced a lot of economic tension and stress in the last couple of years. That could be essentially what's driving this. But I will also just say that among the folks who were negative in past surveys, the responses tend to look very similar. So there are a small subset of folks who feel like there have been rate increases. And then beyond that, we start to get into a sample size of just three or four that have a particular concern in terms of responsiveness or efficiency. But those tend to be the themes that categorize the folks who had a more negative response. On the next slide, we'll get into a breakdown of what goes into those overall satisfaction scores. So let me start with two particular areas that the PUD has checked in years past and again this year, reliability and quality of communication. So you can see that we asked our participants to rate the PUD on these two dimensions on the same 1 to 5 scale, and your scores on reliability are even higher than your overall satisfaction. 3/4 gave the PUD a 5 on reliability, and another 20% nearly a 4. On quality of communication, the scores are nearly as high, almost 70% a 5, and then 20% a 4. Really, almost no one provided scores of 1 or 2 on either reliability or quality of communication. And you'll see on the next slide that that mirrors what we found in 2020. So if you could just switch to that next slide, Rebecca, you'll see how consistent those measures have been over the years, even dating back prior to that 2020 change in overall satisfaction. On the next slide, we got a little bit deeper on some of the factors that can influence the public's relationship with their PUD. So what we asked is, please rate how well Chelan County PUD communicates with customers on several topics. Please use a scale of 1 to 5, where 1 is poor and 5 is excellent. So this is really breaking down their communications relationship with the PUD. What you'll notice is that communications across these different metrics on the monthly bill, on managing customer accounts, on outages, and on saving and becoming more efficient are all broadly positive. The main difference here is that almost everyone feels like they can rate the PUD in terms of its communications on their monthly bill, whereas there are a handful of folks who feel like they're not quite as sure when it comes to ways to manage your account, outages, and providing ways to save and become more efficient. On those three bottom horizontal bars, you'll notice that the don't know folks on the far right in the gray creep up a little bit more, because there are just some residential customers who don't feel equipped to say, yeah, I can really rate them one way or the other on providing ways to save and become more efficient, but I do feel better equipped to rate them on the dimension of communicating about my monthly bill. So those who do rate you on those dimensions are overwhelmingly positive. That's the main difference between those four communications aspects. On the next slide, you can see that really there has not been a significant shift in terms of these communications dimensions. They have been positive in 2020, they remain positive in 2022, and the shifts that you see really are not outside the margin of error. Let's continue to the next slide. And this is where we get into perceptions of the value provided by Chelan PUD to the community. So the question prompt for these small grouping of questions was, please choose whether you agree or disagree with the following brief statements. 1 means strongly disagree, 5 means strongly agree. The first is, I'm satisfied with the value of Chelan PUD services. 89% agree with that statement. The disagreement, I think, is 3 to 4%. The numbers are quite similar on Chelan PUD enhances quality of life here in Chelan County. And they are similarly positive, although slightly higher in terms of the folks who aren't sure, when it comes to Chelan PUD, staff are trustworthy and Chelan PUD prioritizes safety. Again, I think some customers just aren't quite as well equipped to make assessments on those dimensions, but those who are offer very positive feedback. On the next slide, you'll see perceptions about customer service specifically. 5 means exceeds expectations. 1 means falls short of your expectations. So across the board here, from treats me as an individual and with respect, to Chelan PUD is responsive to customer needs, to Chelan PUD employees are experienced, knowledgeable, and proactive, the scores are very positive. So this is starting to flesh out some of those open-ended responses that we saw at the beginning in terms of the fact that people feel like their satisfaction with the PUD goes beyond just price, but it also goes to the way that the PUD communicates with them, the way that staff interacts with them, and the way that they feel the PUD is responsive to their needs. On the next slide, you can see once again there's been very little shift here. I don't want to belabor this, but would rather save time for questions at the end. So let's go ahead and skip to the next slide. We did check in on outreach with the community to make sure that residential customers feel like they can get the kind of engagement they need from the PUD. When it comes to their preferred methods of interacting with the PUD, we asked them to prioritize these different methods. Keep in mind, these were not mutually exclusive. So each one was rated either a 4 or a 5 in terms of the data you see on this slide. In other words, as a high priority. And text, email, and voicemail alerts were the top priority, just edging out online outage center and map and online bill payment. These were all a high priority for a majority of residential customers, but those direct alerts by smartphone took the cake in terms of their breadth of appeal. And you can see that that applies to most audiences on the next slide. When we break this down by age and also by race, you'll note that across the communities in Chelan PUD, there's not a whole lot of difference. And in fact, text, email, and voice alerts are the top preferred method of contact for all of these different groups. There is a little bit more of a preference for some of these online tools, the bill payment and the outage center and map, among slightly younger residents and among the Latino community. But generally speaking, these are priorities that are shared across the county. On the next slide, you'll see preferred sources for PUD news and updates. Overwhelmingly, residential customers say it's the Connected Mail newsletter that makes them feel informed, gives them the news they need about the PUD. So nearly 2-to-1 compared to any other news source. There are some differences in preference here based on different parts of the community. And clearly there is an audience for the website, for stories in the newspaper or on the radio, and for social media and ads. So on the next slide, you can see how that breaks down a little bit. What I should say there is that I think we may have cut this slide for time, but essentially the takeaway is that folks across the county prefer the Connected newsletter. Younger folks tend to be those who are most engaged with social media and some of those other avenues, as you might have expected. In terms of this final question that we ask our respondents, is there anything else you want Chelan PUD staff to be aware of, their chance to sort of air any concerns they have or pass along anything to PUD staff? And again, we gave them the chance to respond in their own words. What it came down to was the bulk of folks just said, hey, you know, we like our relationship with the PUD. We're satisfied with the quality of services they provide. There were also a smattering of other responses that fell into a fairly diverse array of categories. I know that John Stoll has spent some time with those and making sure that those are addressed and sort of heard by the staff. But most folks really said, no, there's nothing else. We feel like we were able to give the feedback we needed to. This last slide, and then I'll open it up to questions and feedback. On the next one is, are you planning to purchase an electric car or truck at some point in the future? So about two-thirds, a little less than two-thirds said no, but about a third said yes, and they had a concrete timeline for it. So 4% in the next year, but that number increases as we get a little bit further out, 7% in the next 1 to 2 years, another 13% in 3 to 5 years, another 13% in 5+ years. So some differences there, but a clear appetite among some in the county to start to transition to EVs. So let me stop there and open it up to any questions, feedback, concerns, questions.
Dennis.
Yeah, Alex, if I may, do you have access to any comparisons related to satisfaction of customers with investor-owned utilities or other PUDs? I like where we are, but it also could be relative to where other providers are. Any data?
Yes, so we do have data from other similar customers. Probably the best comparison for you is Grant PUD. They've publicly released theirs just in the same way that Chelan PUD releases yours. So I can share this without violating any sort of customer confidentiality. Their numbers look very similar overall. Those reports, I'm sure, are easily available on their website, or I can also pass them along if they give me their permission to do so. Typically, their targets for customer satisfaction look very similar to where Chelan PUD is. The one thing that I'll say as a pollster and not as a utility practitioner, so take it with a grain of salt, is that I've seen enough public opinion data to know that when you're consistently flirting with a 90% satisfaction target and rating, that it is a high bar to set for yourselves. We rarely see public opinion that consistent on anything. If you look at national polls on issues or candidates or organizations, it's difficult to maintain that level of consistency among such a large majority of the public. So that's not to suggest that anything that Chelan PUD is doing should be changed, but rather I think just a recognition that achieving such high levels over time puts you in a small class of our overall public opinion customers who are setting those sorts of goals and trying to meet them. And it does mean that when there are dips, sometimes you will feel them, but those dips are inevitable. I think you're previous pollster had mentioned that 97% was a pretty high bar and probably not sustainable. And certainly in my experience, that's right. But I think, the very long way of answering your question, the closest allegory we have, I think, is Grant PUD. There are other PUDs, but you two are some of the lowest price for unit of power that we work with. And that puts you in a kind of separate class from some of the other utilities that draw from other more conventional sources. And because there's such a direct relationship between rates and satisfaction, I think that's also something worth noting. So I hope that at least helped. I know it was a long way of answering.
It's a good reminder. Thank you. Anyone else? Any questions for Alex?
I'd like to make a few comments. Just a couple of observations. One, these great scores don't happen by themselves, and that our employees that work hard day in and day out are certainly being recognized here today, too, from these results. And also just I think it's pretty clear that our customers' expectations of us are changing at the same time and that we're going to have to be very innovative in order to keep up with their expectations as they change. And so we're not taking these scores as an indicator of what we are doing currently or is the right thing that's going to help us maintain these high levels of satisfaction in the future, but recognizing that we're going to have to change with the customer's expectations as well. And so we know that we have our work cut out for us going forward as well, and we're up to the task.
I think it'll be also interesting, kind of as a baseline, to see as we switch over to smart meters and more information coming to our customers, how they respond to that. So I'm going to be looking forward to that in the future as well. All right. Any other comments? And I guess, Kirk, that brings up the question for me is I'll be interested later on to hear how you share that information and those kudos to staff. Maybe put that on your list of to-dos later down the road. Keep us up to date on that. I'd like to hear a little bit more about that.
You bet.
Alex, thank you very much. Great presentation, and always look forward to seeing that data.
Thank you all. Take care.
Thank you for your time. Okay. Fire safety outage.
Yep. So item number four on our agenda is fire safety outage management update. With us in the boardroom, we have Rachel Hansen, Chad Bowman, and Chad Rissman. And I'll briefly introduce this. This team has done a tremendous amount of work in the last few years, getting us to the place where we're at today. And I think the important thing to recognize here is that we all know that this is a larger risk than it has been in the past, both for the public and for a utility. And so what this team has done is look at where are the biggest risks for Chelan County and where does Chelan County PUD play a part in reducing risks, both associated with fires that would damage utility infrastructure and public infrastructure, but also risks of operating electrical system that presents interesting challenges in itself in terms of potential to start fires. So they've been working hard on both fronts. And with that, I'll turn it over to Rachel Hansen to kick us off here.
Good morning, Kirk, and good morning, commissioners. Thank you. So this morning, we wanted to share with you an update on our wildfire mitigation plan. And this plan is rooted in best practices and tailored to the communities that we serve. Our goal here is to strike a balance between safe operations of our lines in fire-prone areas and maintaining reliability for our customer owners. So first, we're going to start with reviewing the risk assessments for Chelan County, as some of the discussion today will focus on areas that are most vulnerable to wildfire. We will talk about the progress that we've made on our wildfire mitigation plan, and we've learned a lot over the last year. We're committed to improving as we learn more and as conditions evolve. We've got some recommendations, not for board action today, but we'd love your feedback. And I'll hand it over to Chad Rissman to talk about risk in distribution.
Thank you, Rachel. Chad Rissman, good morning, commissioners. Got me on camera. Okay. So we made several assessments of both the distribution and transmission system. Chad Bowman will talk a little bit about the transmission system over the last few years. And we recognize that all of Chelan County has elevated fire risk. And we wanted to devise a methodology to where we could understand where we should best be focusing our resources first and going after the areas. So we came up with this tiered concept here that was borrowed from some of the other states and utilities that have performed that. So the risk assessments were really rooted in fuel levels, forested vegetative areas where there was a higher risk, risks of risks at risk, I guess, or values at risk, with which were a number of things, property, forested areas, several other things, took into consideration climate. And we looked at those areas where we have our existing infrastructure. We have about just under 2,000 miles of distribution line throughout the county. So we came up with this tiered concept here to help us understand where we're going to focus our efforts. You can see the biggest concentration of the Tier 3, which is we're considering as the area we want to focus in first, is this kind of greater plain and Lake Wenatchee area, the upper valley area. Shown here in the red is the Tier 3. You can see our overall distribution system by line miles of the just under 2,000 miles of line. 15% of that is in the Tier 3 area, so again, we're focused our efforts there. Next page. And Chad Bohm, we'll talk a little bit about similar things on the transmission side.
Sure, Chad Bohm on the transmission. So on the transmission side, you'll likely recall that 5 years ago we had HDR, worked with HDR to perform a wildfire study, really looking at the effects of wildfire on our transmission lines. And that study really identified two primary areas of risk where fire damaging those transmission lines impacts service levels to customers and are hard places to go and repair. So you'll see down in the bottom right there that Chelan area, we, as you know, rebuilt that section of line in steel last fall, so we've remediated that concern. We're still working on that plain Lake Wenatchee area. As you know, we did some outreach a few years ago. Got some good feedback from the community. We're currently working to develop a third alternative, which we anticipate bringing forward for your comments and thoughts probably later this summer. So really on the transmission side, we're hard at work trying to improve the resilience of the infrastructure.
So those are the risk areas. Now let's talk about our overall fire mitigation plan. We've made a lot of progress. In 2021, Chelan PUD nearly tripled its vegetation management program. We implemented a more frequent inspection and pruning cycle. And as a result, Chelan PUD removed about 5,000 hazard trees. And in 2022, we're planning about the same amount. And then that work is going to be focused on Chihuahua Loop, Lake Wenatchee, Plain, Leavenworth, and Inniat River Road. This effort also improves reliability for fiber as well. We turned off auto reclosing in Lake Wenatchee and Plain area during the fire season. And that means that when something hits the power line, power will stay off until we can inspect and crews give the all clear and we can restore the line safely. We'll talk more about this later. Moving more on to fire hardening, how we do that really depends on the fire ecology of that area. In places with low flashy fire, like sagebrush and grasses, we apply a fire retardant paint around our wooden poles. And in other areas, for example, in Chelan, we converted 34 transmission structures to steel last year. And as Chad Bowman said, we are looking at more places where that might be appropriate. We're also undergrounding distribution lines where it's feasible. Again, another benefit to electricity and fiber service. And then with coordination with other agencies, fire risk is bigger than any one agency can tackle alone. So for one example, we're working with State Department of Natural Resources and Cascadia Conservation District to pool our resources and share what we know in a grant-funded program to build more strategic fuel breaks in our high-risk areas. And I put fire safety outage management last because truly it's a measure of last resort and a small part of a much bigger plan. So for review, a fire safety outage is a proactive power outage that's intended to prevent power lines and equipment from sparking an uncontrollable fire. Last spring, we implemented this plan in the area with our highest fire risk, which is Lake Wenatchee Plain. That area represents about 4,000 customer meters. We collaborated with local fire experts and weather experts to create guidelines that were specific to the fire ecology of this area. And when we begin to see extreme fire weather in the forecast, we'll call together an internal incident command team to validate that data and closely monitor the forecast. We'll notify our emergency management partners and fire districts. And then if those conditions appear to be imminent, we'll notify our customers, ideally 48 hours in advance, and then again 24 hours ahead of time. Once that weather passes, we'll send out crews to investigate the lines, which could take around 8 hours, depending on conditions. And once they give the all clear, we'll restore power. We believe this kind of outage could last between 24 and 36 hours, again, depending on conditions. And if you remember, we coordinated with several different working groups, including cell phone carriers, emergency responders, water purveyors, and vulnerable populations in that area to better understand the impacts and refine the plan. So one question that we're often asked about fire safety outages is, how often do you expect to use this? Because we haven't had to use it yet. We analyzed historical weather data, and in the last 7 years, there was only one date when this pilot area saw extreme weather conditions where we might call for a fire safety outage. That was July 17th, 2014, which was the day that Carlton Complex Fire made its big run. So the key point here is a fire safety outage, we think, might be a 5 to 7 year event. That's based on historical data. And as we know, with climate change, you know, those historical patterns are changing. We haven't had to use it yet, but we are prepared in the event that those conditions come up. Chad Rissman will talk about some of the lessons learned from last year.
Thank you, Rachel. As Rachel mentioned, we're trying to balance that reliability for our customers and also risk to the system and risk to folks and wildland fire. So we look back. One of the things that Rachel mentioned is that we changed the sensitivity, essentially. She called it non-reclosing. But we changed around the way that our system operates in this Plain and Lake Wenatchee area, where the circuit breakers do not reclose after they've operated. So the idea there is that arcing and sparking would be reduced in the event that there was an incident. So by increasing that sensitivity, we saw a big jump or a decay in the reliability as a result. We were expecting that to occur, but it occurred actually. It was greater than what we anticipated. Just a little bit of background information. We consider an outage just for the for reporting purposes. If the power's out for 5 minutes or longer, then it's a recorded outage. If it's under that, then it's not a recorded outage. It's a momentary. Another thing on this table too is customer hours out. So if one customer or one meter is out for 1 hour, that's one customer hour. So in these stats, really, some of the same meters could be out for on different times and still be adding into the totals here. So the big thing to identify here is 2019 and 2020 were fairly consistent, fairly close, and then we see a big jump in 2021, and a lot of that was in the Plain and Lake Wenatchee area. Diving down deeper into the causes of those, we saw a fair amount were wildlife related, so these are squirrels and other things. The other group of them was equipment needing repair, and then also some vegetation. Despite additional vegetation management in the area, it looks like there's more work that we could do there, but at least that number was lower. And then the unknown and others, those were just things that were not immediately identified by the first responder when they went up there and identified the power out. Power was restored and came back on. So we really want to focus in on two areas for some of our improvements over time. We want to build back the reliability and put some different things in place while keeping the system as safe as we can. So we've got some concepts and some things that we're moving forward with. And there's two areas, really. We want to target both the cause of what caused the outage, and we also want to target the consequence. So both will have an impact, a positive impact on reliability. So if an event does occur, we want to limit that event to the certain area, but we also want to target the areas where we're the causes. So the first one up here is wildlife guarding. You saw on the previous slide that there was a significant number of those that are wildlife guarding. These are, as a photo of it on the right side there, there's a red tape and guarding. They tend to, squirrels especially, tend to go across areas where there's a shorter distance between a ground and something that was energized. So putting animal guards and shields and barriers and things up on the poles to try to reduce the animal contact. On the consequence side, what we are wanting to do is we're installing devices that are out in the field. We call them SCADA. That's a term we like to use. It means remote control of our devices, so we can operate and see our devices remotely out in the system. We can also control them. So we're adding remote telemetry and control capabilities to some of the equipment out in this Greater Plain and Lake Wenatchee area so that we can change the state of those devices depending on the conditions. So last year we went into the fire condition, a more sensitive condition, in the end of May, and we didn't come out until September. This would allow us the ability, based on the conditions, the wind conditions, we could come in and out of that state throughout the summer, rather than making it a seasonal state. So we're also installing on the lower left there, there's fault indicators, and these things are pretty cool. They help the first responder identify where the potential issue is. So there's a kind of a reddish amber light that flashes that says, hey, the problem is past me. So the first responder can look at those. We'll be putting more of those out. And then also doing some tuning of our system based on the experience that we learned from last year. Rachel mentioned undergrounding. Something to this scale, I have not, in my 25 years here at the district, taken on. This is a very big project. There are certain characteristics of these conversions that we need to look for to make these feasible. But one of the things that we kept hearing from the fire experts, the River Road area kept coming up into the conversations, and there seemed to be a theme that there was concern. There's heavy, very tall vegetation. There's one way in and one way out. There just seemed to be, by the fire experts, that this is an area of focus. So we took a look at the River Road area, and we thought that there might be some characteristics here where undergrounding might be feasible. We're still in the planning phases. The board has approved some funding of $1 million into the budget for this year. We're meeting with the community on Saturday, this coming Saturday. There's some specific things that we're going to work with and have to collaborate with the community up there. We're going to have to convert certain sections of lines. We're going to have to change the services and how it connects up to the home. We'll be seeking different easements because we'll be taking a different route than the overhead system would be. So there's a lot of complexities, a lot of coordination, collaboration that will need to be done in order to pull this off. But we're moving forward with it. We'll be doing this in a few phases. One of the benefits of the River Road area is a couple of years ago, we worked with the communications group Zipley, who was doing some undergrounding in the area, and we worked with them to have some electrical conduit installed in the ground at the same time that they were putting in conduit for the communication, their communication system. So there's a significant amount of conduit that's already in the ground that was a part of another project. We joint funded and received some benefits from that. So we're looking forward to this project and moving it forward, and we're going to learn some lessons from how we do this and hope to apply that to other areas. One area we're looking at is the Braeburn area, also in the Plain Lake Wenatchee area. So we'll be moving that forward and moving through planning and hopefully into execution later this year, if not next year.
Thanks, Chad. So just for review, go ahead, Gary.
Thank you. Just a quick question. Back one previous slide, please.
Yep.
So the distance of that River Road area that is being considered for undergrounding, can you tell me how long is that road, or how much distance would require the undergrounding?
So the substation's plain substation is up at the top of River Road by the fire station. So we're looking ultimately to underground the majority of that, and we're taking it in three or four phases. This phase that you're looking at here is at the end of the line. So we're starting at the end and working back. This is about from the railroad tracks to the end of the line, and it's just about a mile.
So in total, all three phases, about how long is that?
I can't remember exactly. It's right around 3 miles, I think.
Okay. So, and the reason I'm asking is I remember from our conversations of undergrounding in the Lake Chelan area that we were quoted about $1 million a mile. Is that right, traditionally?
That's correct. I mentioned that there are some fiber conduit, or excuse me, some electrical and fiber conduits that are already in the ground on certain parts of this, which will help in reducing some of those costs. There are also a number of services that are going to existing homes and cabins and structures that are already underground. There's parts of this that are already underground, so we're going to be able to take advantage of some of those things, but the $1 million a mile is a really good high-level estimate in my experience.
Great. Thanks, Chad. Appreciate that.
Okay, so just for review, in the Lake Wenatchee Plain area, we're going to invest in reliability improvements. We're going to continue with four crews of vegetation management. We're going to underground where feasible, and we're going to continue preparing for potential fire safety outages, both internally and with the community. In other Tier 3 areas, we plan to increase the sensitivity of our system in the forested areas, Upper Blewett, Calocum, and Aswell. These are relatively small rural areas with about 460 people total. We estimate that this change will impact overall reliability by about 1.3 minutes system-wide. We need to get a better idea of wildfire risk in non-forested areas and what mitigation might be appropriate based on the fire behavior in these areas. So we're going to be reaching out to fire districts and kind of the weather experts to better understand the conditions in these areas. And that said, none of our lines are exempt from de-energization. If there's an active fire, it's pretty common that we would de-energize at the request of incident command to protect firefighters. In a more improbable scenario, if our county is experiencing crisis-level wildfire conditions, and it's clear that de-energizing is the right thing to do, we do reserve the right to make that call. That said, we're committed to evolving this fire mitigation plan, and we've built a good foundation so far, and we'll continue to improve and adapt as we go. And for our last slide, at this point, our efforts are focused on reaching out to the Lake Wenatchee Plain community so that they're aware of the improvements that we plan to make for better reliability, as well as how to prepare for fire season. We've got, like Chad said, we've got a meeting coming up on Saturday with the River Road neighborhood, and we're also preparing to meet with our expert working group of fire districts and emergency responders and partner agencies to give them an update on this plan. In our other Tier 3 areas, that outreach would be focused on fire district leadership and other partner agencies so we can better understand local conditions. So with that, I'll open it up for questions, commissioners.
Great overview, Rachel, Chad, and Chad. Commissioners, any other questions for them? That was a lot of information.
Just a quick off-the-wall question for Chad Risman. In the last, you know, since I've been a commissioner for 16 years now, when I first became a commissioner, the wildlife problem with distribution, especially distribution, was confined mainly to East Wenatchee and ground squirrels. Is our squirrel population overtaking the county?
I'm not a biologist, but I can tell you this. We've installed a lot of animal guards and continue to install animal guards, yet the outages associated with animals continue to rise. So I think that would be a good conclusion, but we'll continue to install animal guards and do some undergrounding and try to learn some lessons and improve. The animal guards, too, they've evolved over the years. UV breakdown, they get brittle. Environmental conditions like wind and snow and things tend to knock them off and reduce their effectiveness. So there's a little bit of that that happens, but I think the squirrel, among other wildlife, has definitely increased, and they've discovered the use of our power system as a highway.
you wouldn't you think they give that their Darwin? Yeah, wouldn't you think the Darwin theory would take over at some point, that the dumb squirrels would die and the smart ones would figure it out? You know, you can always hope.
Okay.
The other thing, if we underground Braeburn, that'll cut the commissioner's email about in half.
Gary?
Thanks. Real quick question for Chad. I noticed on your diagram that there was an area down in the Clockham that was highlighted in red. I wasn't able to identify that specific area. Is that the Tarpiskan, or what is that area down there?
Correct. Tarpiskan, correct. And Clockham, Upper
okay.
Clockham.
Great. Thanks. I appreciate that.
Again, Rachel, Chad, and Chad, thank you for the update and great information. Surprisingly, I'm going to put it this way. I get a lot of people saying those poor squirrels, and can't you do something about that? So it really makes me happy, guys, to be able to say we are doing something to help protect our squirrels and take care of them. So thank you very much for the report. And Kirk, let's move on into our capital project funding.
Okay. With us in the boardroom is Heather Ireland, who's going to give us an update on capital project funding. No action requested today, but she's going to bring forward a couple items that she'll be seeking guidance on today and bring back for decisions at the next board meeting on the 20th. She's logging into the computer as we speak.
You know, go figure, it locks right before I sit down.
Kirk, before we start that, I did a little peek in the bag related to investor-owned utilities and customer satisfaction. And of 1,000 that were surveyed, their satisfaction was 73.2%. Oh. So I think that puts ours in interesting perspective.
Yeah, thank you for that.
Good morning, Commissioners. Heather Ireland, Director of Treasury, here this morning to talk about some capital funding opportunities available for us this year and into future years. Oh, there we go. So this morning, why we're here is specifically just for information. No required action today, but in preparation, as Kirk said, for next board meeting on June 20th, where I do intend to return to ask for a couple action items. The first action item is related to the Designated Headquarters Service Center Strategic Facilities Fund and a request to begin using funds from that account. The second action item to request will be the adoption of a reimbursement resolution related to preserving the option for future tax-exempt debt issuances. So starting off, I wanted to talk a little bit about capital funding from a board-designated fund. The district has cash reserves that can be used to fund any capital projects, but sometimes it makes sense for the board to take action in advance of a capital project to designate the specific future uses of those monies. In 2017, the board did do this. They passed a motion to create a board-designated fund specifically for investment in future long-term facilities. In 2017, there was also a motion passed to deposit $20 million into this fund. And then in 2018, there was a subsequent motion to deposit an additional $30 million into the fund. So therefore, today, there is a total balance of $50 million in the Strategic Facilities Fund available for project use. It made sense at the time to designate those funds as the projects were being planned well into the future, and the use of the funds wouldn't be necessary for many years. However, it was advanced planning to ensure that the monies were set aside when the project did occur. Because the board directs the use of those funds, the proposed action for June 20th will be for the board to adopt make a motion and pass a motion to begin having staff use the funds in that account. So one question that I think will immediately come to mind is we have been working on the service center for many years now, and there still is a $50 million balance in that board designated fund. And the reason that we have not drawn on those funds yet is because we had other sources of funds with more restrictions on them that it made sense to use first. And specifically, those were the tax-exempt bonds that we issued in 2020. Tax-exempt bonds can only be used for limited purposes, and one of those purposes is qualified projects. And qualified, I put in quotes on the slide, because it does have a pretty specific definition according to the federal government. Qualified projects for tax-exempt bonds include things with a general governmental purpose that have little private party benefit and aren't funded with other specific designated resources. We have just finally expended the remainder of those 2020 bond proceeds, and that's why I would be returning to you at the next meeting to request the authority to begin using those board-designated funds for the service center. The service center is a good example of a qualified project because it supports a general governmental purpose, specifically our distribution system that serves our entire service area. Distribution projects are also an excellent example, and that is also an area where we've spent a significant portion of the 2020 bonds on things like substations and our advanced metering infrastructure. We can also use other sources of cash for capital projects, but to the extent we designate them to do so, we can't also use tax-exempt funding. Tax-exempt funding is often the lowest cost option for the district, and by doing a comprehensive evaluation of the overall district needs, we are able to achieve the lowest overall cost for the district. We can do that by utilizing tax-exempt funds for projects that qualify, such as distribution or service center type projects. And then we can use other cash resources for projects that would not qualify for tax exempt financing. A really good example of that would be the district's hydro projects. Because we sell a portion of the output to private parties, in most cases, we're not able to fund that type of capital investment with tax exempt proceeds. So again, using tax-exempt proceeds for projects that qualify allows us to use other cash for projects that would not qualify for tax-exempt funding, keeping our overall costs as low as possible. So how and when we borrow does matter, and we are able to use proactive capital funding strategies that I described to maximize our tax-exempt authority by borrowing for those types of projects. We do have current financial forecasts that indicate the district will be able to continue funding the majority of our capital projects with cash reserves. However, there is a modest amount of borrowing included in our financial forecast beginning as early as next year in 2023. Because of that, and because of the desire to maintain the lowest cost possible financing, we would propose that on June 20th, the board would adopt a resolution called a reimbursement resolution to preserve the option to fund future projects with tax-exempt bonds, but not obligate us in any way to do so. How we do that is because of a technical requirement within the IRS guidelines. It allows the district to continue to fund qualified projects today with available cash resources, and that at a later date, within a limited time frame, up to approximately 18 to 36 months later, issue bonds and reimburse ourselves from the proceeds of those bonds. So we can fund, use cash on hand to fund our projects today that would qualify for tax-exempt funding, but then we can issue bonds in the future to reimburse ourselves for those projects we've already expended funds on. I'm proposing a not-to-exceed amount of $100 million, which is well in excess of our current projected needs, but again, that provides us maximum flexibility. So the option to issue, but not the obligation to. To give you an idea of what the timeline may look like for a future bond issuance, on June 20th, the board would consider the reimbursement resolution, providing flexibility for future bond issuances. In the fall of 2022, I'd return with our annual plan of finance, where we discuss each year at the board level what our projections are for external funding needs. And depending on the timing and amount of any external funding needs, I could return to the board as early as 2023 to propose development of offering documents and have the board consider a resolution to actually authorize bond issuance. That's the point where it's our go-no-go decision point where the board would actually determine if we should issue bonds or not. After that decision point, we would publish documents, offering documents, and sell bonds. Depending on the timing this fall, based on our financial forecast and projection of our needs, that time frame could be, like I said, as early as early 2023, or it could shift later. It could be later next year, or even potentially into 2024, depending on where the district is at later this year. So the two actions I would be returning to the board on June 20th for would be first a motion to direct the use of $50 million board designated strategic facilities fund on project costs. And the second request would be adoption of a resolution to preserve the future reimbursement options, maximizing tax exempt bond issuance authority. And I'll pause there for questions or discussion.
Heather, a question that is sort of along the lines. We apparently have just entered an era of now, for at least the near term, rising interest rates. Looking down the road, and I recognize that nobody has a clear crystal ball. What is that likely to do if we go into out for bonds? Are the interest rates that we're paying going to be substantially higher?
Based on today's conditions, I would not say substantially higher. So one of the things that the district deals with is we are impacted by interest rates both in the short term and the long term. So short term interest rates have risen rapidly. Those would be the types of rates you would see on short term treasury bills and bonds. Eventually, maybe bank savings accounts, although those have been slower to move. But we hear a lot about in the media and discussion, the Federal Reserve and the Fed funds rate. And those short-term rates have moved up fairly rapidly. However, longer-term rates, which is normally what most impacts things like mortgages and the district's borrowing rates, have moved up more slowly. They're definitely higher than they were this time last year. But they are not so high that they are concerning to the district from an issuance standpoint. We also have high quality credit and access to tax-exempt bonds, which help keep our rates lower that we would be borrowing at. And in addition, we are in a position where we are able to fund the majority of our capital program with cash. So even if we are issuing bonds, the amount of bonds we'll be issuing is smaller than would otherwise occur. Therefore, even with higher interest rates, we're less impacted just because the volume of transactions that we need to process is smaller.
Thank you.
Any other questions, commissioners? Dennis.
Yeah, Heather, what is the overall estimated cost of the service center?
The overall cost that I have for capital funding purposes is about $140 million. We have so far spent about $65 million towards the service center project out of bond proceeds. We plan to utilize another $50 million from the savings account, and this reimbursement resolution would provide us the option to fund an additional $25 million with tax-exempt bond proceeds. So from a capital funding perspective, that's what we have covered at this point in time.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Heather, thank you very much.
Looks like we have one more. Ann,
we have one more question, thank you. Oh, sorry, Ann, I didn't see your hand up.
That's okay. I tried to put my little hand down there.
Yeah, I didn't see that.
That's okay, it's small. Heather, thank you. Great report. So when Dennis's question, interesting. I've had some people ask me that same question lately, and I was a little off on my estimate. So the number that you just gave us, that is just for the service center. That's not all the work we've done at Rock Island and the work we've done and buildings and so forth at Rocky Reach. That's just the service center.
Yep, that's just the service center capital funding portion that we have lined out at this point.
So, and that was 100 and?
140 million.
Mm-hmm. 40 million, okay. Rock Island, Rocky Reach improvements, new buildings improvements, modernization. Can you give us a ballpark on that?
I don't have access to that information right now, but we can follow up with that and send that to all of the commissioners.
Sure, great. Okay, thank you.
Other questions for Heather? All right. As always, Heather, lots of information to digest. Great presentation. Thank you very much. And we will see you at our next meeting.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Yes, the next two items include Rob Davis, semi-annual transmission update, and interconnection agreement, items number 6 and 7 on the agenda. And just for you to be thinking, Commissioner McKenna, I'm thinking about recommending moving agenda item 9 ahead of 8, just because it's really important for us to get the feedback before this afternoon there. Okay, Rob, take it away. Rob's always efficient with these presentations. So,
thanks, Kirk, and good morning, commissioners. Rob Davis, staff attorney here at the district. Chad Bowman joining me also to give you our semi-annual transmission update. Really jazz things up with some diving into transmission policy. So we are here to cover just broadly changes in the transmission landscape as part of the resolution that the commission adopted our tariff under last December. There was a direction to staff to come back and provide updates on transmission. Sorry, I think I might have dropped out there. So we've come back and we talk about things that have happened in the FERC world and elsewhere impacting transmission so that we can make reasoned, informed decisions about whether or not to modify our tariff for the future. So with that, we have a big transmission development from FERC and one video. I am have some heads up.
Yeah, you're breaking up on us a little bit, Rob.
You might try shutting your video off, Rob, right. See if that helps.
You there, Rob?
Okay. Is that any better?
That is better.
Yes.
At least it was.
Give me just... Okay, I am trying one more time. Is that any better?
Yeah, that is, Rob.
Okay, I apologize for that. I've switched to a new device. So, jumping right in, we have a FERC Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, a very long title that you see there, but it is directed towards regional transmission planning and cost allocation. So in Order 1000, FERC set up a regional transmission policy where utilities, in addition to doing their own individual transmission planning, had to join a region and look at whether there were projects that were better from a cost and policy perspective for that broader region. And if there was, they had to share in the cost of that project commensurate with the share of benefits they received from it. So they are looking to make improvements on this policy in this rulemaking. And so there will be some changes that come out for the FERC pro forma tariff. Again, these will only apply to us if we decided to adopt them. Our tariff is voluntary. We're not a jurisdictional transmission utility. And then we are not enrolled in Northern Grid's regional planning process. So Northern Grid does regional planning under Order 1000 for all the IOUs in the broader Northwest. We participate in Northern Grid on the more general Order 890 transmission planning process, but not for the cost allocation. So we'll go to the next slide and dive into some of the details around this proposal. So FERC is requiring for regional transmission planning that utilities and the transmission regions use long-term scenarios to start identifying transmission needs. So ordinarily, a transmission plan will look 10 years in the future, and a transmission bill can take 10 years or more. So FERC is directing that these be longer-term scenarios. Each utility and region needs at least 4 plausible and diverse scenarios about what the future resource and demand mix might look like. And it has to look no less than 20 years into the future. So taking a much longer time horizon into account to identify what transmission needs might be more broadly. FERC is also going to identify a set of factors within different categories for transmission regions to investigate, try to get more of a uniform look at things like changing technologies, changing governmental regulations, or corporate and utility commitments to go to a higher percentage of renewables, so that if these factors are in play, that the transmission regions will be required to consider them. And also requiring the consideration of geographic zones, so that if there are areas that are better for considering for transmission build-out for reasons of large wind or large solar potential, that is actively considered as part of the long-term scenario process. Next slide. Other transmission planning reforms that the transmission facilities will consider if a utility or set of utilities has recurring interconnection needs. So as part of the interconnection process, a generator submits their request, it gets studied, and the utility might identify upgrades that it needs on its system in addition to the actual interconnection. But if that developer drops out of either the project is no longer economic or for some other reason, maybe they don't want to pay for the facilities, then it kind of goes back to square one. Next developer comes and submits a request, perhaps at the same or similar location, and the need for a transmission upgrade is identified again. But it keeps cycling through, and until you get somebody that commits to building and funding, this need won't actually get constructed. It won't be included in the plan. And so this is requiring utilities to take a look and say, if you've had something that keeps coming up but never makes it into the plan because your queue keeps churning, that we want you to put that as part of your transmission plan and not just have it identified through the interconnection process. And they set a threshold there so that it really only is large projects that would be included. But the idea is that, you know, there's probably some benefit to that upgrade. Otherwise, you wouldn't have people continually requesting it. But let's get past the problem of the queue having to start over every time somebody drops out. FERC is also asking for transmission planning to include consideration of things like dynamic line ratings and advanced power flow control, basically looking at whether more modernized and nimble operation of the transmission system changes what's needed from a planning perspective. You know, is there a better way to build out the grid if we are using our assets in a smarter fashion? Next slide. So along with the updates to the regional planning process, FERC is looking to make some changes to the regional cost allocation process. And this was a sticky part of Order 1000. It's going to be a sticky part of this one because it is, for the investor owns, a mandatory cost allocation. So there's no concern that you might get stuck with costs that you aren't actually able to realize through your transmission rates once a project goes forward. So FERC is looking at some ways to try and improve that to encourage more regional projects to be studied and developed. So one thing that they're going to do is include a state entity agreement process that they want to get more direct state involvement in the regional planning process. Northern Grid has a interaction with state commissioners for the investor owns. I think all the other regions, either through their RTO process or through their regional planning process, have similar outreach, but FERC wants a broader state engagement process to get alignment and support for regional projects, since states do have some input and oversight over transmission that goes through their states. FERC wants to eliminate the ability for projects in progress to be included in cost allocation. So what this would do is that if you are developing a project already, it prevents you from trying to slide your project into the regional plan to get cost allocation from your neighbors when you already had this identified for your own needs. So to try and blunt the impact of the mandatory cost allocation so that people aren't on the hook for things that they shouldn't be. It reinstates the right of first refusal. So Order 1000 got rid of this ability for the incumbent utility to basically take over on a project, right of first refusal on a project that was in their plan, that their local plan. FERC's adding some conditions to it that it has to be post joint ownership. Municipals are included in that, municipal and public utility type agencies. Again, the goal is to move more projects forward, and doing this gives a little bit of incentive to an incumbent utility, but it's not unfettered, so they can't completely up in the process and just return to a world where the investor-owned utility really has the ability to build out a system the way it wants without coordination. And then that last bullet there wants to add some more transparency to the local planning process. Again, the cost allocation piece really was, although the goal was to try and spread regional costs or costs for regional projects more broadly to encourage their development, it had a counter effect. And so one of the things that happened was utilities pulled more projects back into their local planning process so they could get them built, get rate of return on them. And so FERC wants to make sure there's more transparency there, so that if there's something that should be a regional project and part of the regional planning process, that it does end up there and that that it isn't sidetracking the regional process. So for us, a little bit about the impact. This will have an effect, obviously, on Northern Grid's regional planning process, and so by extension for the enrolled members, which is currently just the investor-owned utilities in Northern Grid. It would only apply to us if we voluntarily added it to our tariff and then enrolled in the regional region at Northern Grid. I don't anticipate that any of the non-jurisdictionals that are participating in Northern Grid are going to enroll, because the same issues with Order 1000 that caused us all to withhold our enrollment would still apply here. And then for our direct involvement in this proposed rulemaking, we've been participating through LPPC. They've been doing a great job of putting together summaries, marshaling comments, and so we're leaning very heavily on them as we go forward, particularly since it's not a direct impact to us. So we'll pause there if there are any questions about transmission planning or this NOPR. Okay, and hearing none, I will jump to the next update we wanted to share with you, which is something out of the Department of Energy. So as part of the infrastructure bill that was passed last year, the DOE's Building a Better Grid initiative was created. And under that, they have kicked off what they're calling the Transmission Facilitation Program. So this is a set of...
Rob, I'm going to interrupt you just for a second. Kirk, okay. Bear with me here for a minute. I'm just trying to sort through some timing here before this we get into the last presentation. Are you available to come back after lunch?
Yes, I am.
We have about 20 minutes that I think we'd like to fit in our rate schedule before lunch. So if you don't mind, I'd like to postpone finishing up interconnection agreement until after lunch.
Is that okay, Rob?
Yep.
Okay. Then, we'll plan on that. And this is the last slide for the transmission update one. So we'll let Rob finish this one and then move to agenda item number 9. Does that work?
That works. Thank you.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Sure. And just at a high level, DOE's proposed 3 tools to work to improve financing to help get projects built. The first, they submitted last month a notice of inquiry looking for information about the proposals for DOE to enter capacity contracts. So they would look like a transmission customer, basically be a subscriber to help with funding to get a project built. Their thought is that in the short term, they would then resell those transmission agreements, so they wouldn't be on the hook. Taxpayers wouldn't be on the hook long term, but it would be enough to get a project off the ground. And then early next year, they're looking to come back with looking for information on their other 2 proposals, which involve loans and also public-private partnerships where they would actually be a part owner in assets that got built. So again, looking for creative ways to help get over the funding hump and get these capital-intensive and long-term projects built. So with that, I'll wrap and happy to take any questions, or we can move on to the next item.
Great. Thanks, Rob, for your flexibility on that. And we'll come back after lunch and finish, wrap that up.
Okay. Thank you.
So Kirk, let's go ahead and move into item number 9, rate schedule 36. We've been talking about that for quite a long time. And
yep. Thank you.
Keep moving on that.
Yep. Thank you. So item number 9 on the agenda is the discussion in regards to transitioning from rate schedule 35 to rate schedule 36 for those customers that applies to. And our discussion has been mainly around what's the right transition period for that rate adjustment. So I'm going to let Eric lead us off here. Mainly what we're looking for is feedback on, we have a resolution prepared for the afternoon for option 2B, which is the staff recommendation as the best balance between customer concerns and moving towards the new cryptocurrency rate. So, Eric,
thanks.
Maybe I took everything. I don't know.
No, thanks, Kirk. Yeah, Kirk took a lot of it, so it'll be quick, which I'm sure I'll be grateful for. So, Eric Walquist, General Counsel, Commissioners, we're back again to talk about the prospect of transitioning Rate 35 contract customers to Rate 36. I did provide you short summary materials late last week just as a refresher. They're not materials that you haven't seen previously, and they are not materials that have not been previously presented in a public session. So just wanted to make sure you had them easily available in your email. You've also received, I believe, a recent email from Malachi Salcido reiterating his request for 2A. You've heard Kirk mention staff's recommendation at 2B. In terms of the resolution, one of the reasons it was important to hear from you this morning is because we do have the resolution prepared. The resolution that accompanied the board packet was effectively the 2B version. I will tell the board that thanks to a lot of great work by Charles Von Rees here, our staff attorney, we are prepared with any of the previously identified options and could just drop in the right language if the board chooses to go with any of the options that have been put in front of you. If we create a new one here today, we probably need a little bit of time to work. That said, the last item, commissioners, that I will update you on, and then I'll turn it to you, is we did make a couple of changes to the draft resolution since the board packet was published. Those changes are really specifically designed merely to ratify the board's May 16 motion extending the period of time for implementation of the adjusted rate to July 1. Just for clarity, it's ratification of the board's motion there. And then it does also make it clear that start dates for a transition period, should the board act, would be July to July each year. Those are the changes in summary. So happy to ask questions. Otherwise, Commissioner McKenna, I'll turn it to you to facilitate discussion.
Great. Thank you, Rob and others, for your patience. I wanted to provide, as it's been said, the direction for this afternoon, if that's where we're going. So, commissioners, comments, questions? We've been talking about this for a while. How would you like to proceed?
Commissioner McKenna.
Yes.
You know, I understand that at the last meeting, which I wasn't able to attend, the decision-making discussion was postponed to this meeting to ensure that all commissioners were in attendance. And I've been doing a lot of listening in this last several months to the considerations for the various options, and I keep coming back to one of my primary focuses as a commissioner on this. When I'm not in the office, not looking at the sign on the wall right now, the best for the most for the longest, but it's ingrained on my brain, and I think that's an important consideration. I'm wondering if a couple of things might be appropriate. One, I do see Malachi here, and I don't know if there's any other of the affected users that are online today to make some final comments, but I actually would be prepared to make a motion at this time and see if it gets a second and see if we have a discussion on a motion. But I'm wondering if first it wouldn't be appropriate to have any final public input before I did something like that.
And also, whatever motion is made, there'll be a discussion period, and we can
right.
carry that off into the afternoon. So,
you bet we could. So as I'm not hearing anything right now, I would like to move that we adopt Resolution 15 as presented by staff, and I'd like to discuss it, assuming it gets a second. It's a second.
I'll second the motion.
Second.
Okay.
So at this point,
all of a sudden started getting feedback.
Yeah. We're working on it.
Sure.
Okay.
So we have a motion for, it's been seconded for 2B. At this point, I will open it up for discussion.
I speak in support of my motion. Wow, that's weird. Is that at your end, Eric?
Or? No, it's okay. It's okay, Commissioner. Commissioner Congdon unmuted so that she could speak, and it just, you guys are catching each other, that's all.
Okay, okay. Okay, so, I'd like to go back to, well, to supporting my motion. As I said in my opening comments, I've listened for many months, and I think we all five of us commissioners recognize that we all probably land somewhere a little bit different from each of the other commissioners in our personal views of what would represent the best for the most for the longest. I recognize that in my heart of hearts, I'm probably on occasion a little bit of a softie when it comes to providing transition. And in my heart of hearts could in another situation support a more generous transition period. But I also recognize that for us to best support the utility, if it's possible, that all of us, if all of us could align and land on a spot that provides the best for the most for the longest that we can live with as a 5-0 commission, I think that could be a powerful tool working forward. And when I try to make policy, I try to look at not the situation that we're in, but what the next situation we face might look like based on the type of policy we put together here today for this particular situation. I think Commissioner Bowles on a couple of occasions has made a very eloquent statement about the business meeting we were in several years ago at the Roaster upstairs in the hotel in Wenatchee, where the business community was saying, we don't want to have huge surprises facing us. And this particular situation emerged as a surprise for all of us, how much the rates had changed. Now we've been discussing for months on how do we mitigate that and how do we best move forward. My sense is resolution 2B might be a compromise that all of us could live with and support. And looking down the road, we were to face another situation similar to this, that it could be a template by which we could hold our heads high as commissioners and say, we made policy that's for the best, for the most, for the longest, and this is a good template for that policy. So that's my my pitch for what has been recommended, option 2B, which is embodied in resolution number 15. And I'll stop right there.
Thank you, Randy. Ann, you have your hand up? Oh, you're on mute.
There we go. Thank you. Yeah, I'll speak to this because I was the one 2 weeks ago who said at that time, sitting where we were sitting, I could not support the staff recommendation, which is 2B. I've done a lot of work since then. I've talked one-on-one with all the different commissioners, and I feel really strongly we need to have some sort of transition that's important for businesses. I understand how businesses need that in order to plan. So with that said, I will, as Randy said, I will compromise. And I will support 2B at this time.
Any other comments? Dennis.
Thank you. Speaking on behalf of the motion, I'd like to remind us that although if this commission does make a decision today, that does not bind any future commission from altering that decision. Secondly, as this proposal, if accepted, plays out, proves not to be our best collective wisdom, it is always subject to revision, updates, and clarity of thinking. What I see 2B as moving, in the direction of allowing our customers to adjust their business model. And it also allows us in the future to have reconsideration if we have missed our mark. I think at this point, this is our best foot forward and see where it goes. I also recognize if I'm sitting in Malachi's shoes, probably not what I wanted to hear today. And I understand that. And I would encourage Malachi or any other customer that finds himself in this position to continue to petition the board and, further your interest. That's what you're in business for. So, I think this is the best of our wisdom at this time. Let's see where it goes.
Thank you, Dennis. Any other, Gary?
Thank you, Steve. I would like to also make comment in support of the motion. And I have done a great deal of thought on this topic, thinking back to why we established the new rate schedule. And the purpose, so many years ago that we established this, was to protect ratepayers. And I still believe in that concept. What has changed is that the price now associated with this rate, because it is an open market price, has fluctuated greatly and has gone up significantly. That was the unseen element. I strongly feel that if the rate had not increased so significantly, I might feel otherwise about making any accommodation going forward. Because the value of the rate to protect ratepayers and the logic behind that process is still valid. And I might add that what we did as a commission and what we did as a utility was industry leading to create a new rate for this type of demand. So I'm comforted with the belief that we will continue to monitor as we go forward. As progress is made, there will be the ability to offer dialogue amongst our customers and for management to keep an eye on what is happening with the rate. It is not our intent, as Randy pointed out, to do harm. Indeed, what we're trying to do is seek a balance that arrives at what is best for the most, for the longest. So I really have to throw my support in towards this motion as we move forward, with the caveat that we're more than willing to continue to monitor and we seek dialogue with both with Malachi and with others as we move forward to make sure that that we maintain our goal of providing the greatest value for the most people for the longest period of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary. Do I have any other comments regarding the motion?
Commissioner, this is Eric. I just have one point of clarity. Commissioner Smith's motion sought approval of the resolution as presented. Just for clarity, the resolution as presented by staff now contains the clarification regarding the July 1 start date.
Correct.
Yeah.
Any other comments? Hearing none, we will go ahead and vote on the motion
Is there somebody that is?
Oh, that's me.
voting. So I did not mute it, so we can vote. But I will.
All right, let's go ahead and vote. All those in favor of the motion for Schedule 36. Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Thank you very much. Sorry, I struggled with that because I'm hearing myself and it's like my brain is not working. I can't even follow through. I'm not hearing the echo, so thank you. All right, and again, it's been reinforced that we will continue evaluating that as we progress forward, and there is a commitment to do so. Kirk, at this time, we will recess for lunch, and we will come back and finish up interconnection agreement with Rob and Fifth Street Development, and then move into the afternoon agenda. Ann?
Malachi has his hand up.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Malachi.
Commissioner McGinn, do I have a chance to give public comment before the break? Or do I need to come back after the break?
No, you go ahead.
So Malachi Salcedo, 615 North Wenatchee Avenue. Thank you for continuing to interact with me. Even when I don't agree with you, I'm committed to always be respectful and continue the dialogue. Thank you also, Kurt, for committing to review rate schedule 36 before the next market rate adjustment next year. I really appreciate that. I would have preferred to make public comment before you voted, but that is completely within your rights as a commission to move forward as you did. One thing I will say just functionally, because of your decision, you've seen the financials and how on one of our sites that I used an example, we're losing hundreds of thousands of dollars year to date. So just functionally, what we have to do from a business standpoint is we're going to have to reconfigure our spaces in Chelan County, removed the blockchain / cryptocurrency processing servers and replace them with data processing servers that don't fall under the cryptocurrency rate while we spend the next 12 months interacting with the district on whether or not rate 36 is still appropriate, accomplishing its intended goals, or if there's a better way. What's honestly, from my perspective, just as kind of dysfunctional about that is those servers that I have to spend significant dollars to remove and then reinstall have, for all intents and purposes, an identical load profile to the ones I'm taking out. They're just doing a different form of processing. That seems like wasted time and energy. So it's part of the, I think Gary was talking about, from my perspective, there's certain unintended consequences that are happening, and I'm not your only load that's on rate schedule 36, but I'm 80% of it. So I'm disappointed, frankly, because I've got to spend a bunch of money to put a different kind of server on the shelf that consumes the same kind of power and the same load profile that does data processing. So so I can avoid bleeding for the next 12 months while I interact with the district about whether or not Rate 36 is still accomplishing the district's intended purposes. So I don't know if that would have made a difference, but it's just important for you to know. Functionally, the sites are running the same load profile at the same rate, doing a different form of processing. And I think a challenge as we go forward is, do you really want to be in the business of regulating what kind of processing happens on servers in your territory? Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you, Malachi. And I'm sorry, I thought I was clear. I was asking for public comment. Any other comment? So I do appreciate your follow-up remarks. Thank you very much.
Sorry to interrupt, Commissioner. I would encourage you to specify, because if you say comments, I'm assuming when there's a motion on the table, I'm assuming you're only referring to board members. Because once there's a motion on the table, it doesn't really make sense for the public to be interjecting and participating in that discussion. So for future, more clarity would be better for me.
Thank you. All right. At this time, we will recess for lunch, and we will be back at 1 o'clock. Good afternoon, and welcome to June 6th, 2022 business session of the Chelan County Public Utility District Commission meeting. I'd like to remind everyone to please silence any electronic devices you have with you today and mute your screens. We welcome the public's input at our meetings and remind you that these meetings are recorded. If you wish to address any item on the agenda, please raise your hand either physically or electronically on your screen to let us know that you would like to speak. When recognized, please state your name and address for the record and limit your comments to 3 minutes. Okay, so consent agenda. Commissioners, we have a consent agenda in front of us. Nothing has been added to it. Is there a motion to accept the consent agenda?
Mr. Chairman, I move we accept the consent agenda as presented.
Second.
Second.
Is there... all those in favor of the motion to accept the consent agenda state, signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried. Okay, we're moving into the regular agenda, and we have resolutions. I apologize. Kirk, I'm just racing into resolutions, and we still have a couple presentations to make.
Yeah, that's correct. We're prepared to go either way. We were thinking we'd loop back to the presentations if that works for you.
Let's do that, and I'll slow down here and keep myself organized. So let's go back and talk to Rob Davis, if he's still speaking to me after I cut him off halfway through his presentation. Rob, are you still there?
Actually, don't see him on.
That'll teach me.
And I know it's not for that reason, Commissioner McKenna, that you spoke to. So we're prepared. Why don't we, I think we have the right people to take item number 8.
Let's do that, and we'll come back to Rob.
Yeah, and why we're regrouping here, I'll apologize for my agenda creation. I was a little bit over ambitious for the morning session, and it reminds me of our human performance initiative principle number 5, that safety and quality aren't the absence of defects, but the presence of defenses and having margin for things to go as unplanned. So apologize for the busy morning there. Okay.
So let's talk about 5th Street redevelopment.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Dan Frazier, Director of Shared Services. I want to take you through just a brief, real brief recap of what we've done to date, and then kind of status of where we are currently and a little bit of a preview of what's coming up. So it's a no action requested today. It's just for board information. That advance. More technical. I'll let you drive. How's that? Okay. Sorry, commissioners. Have a little technical difficulty here. So I'm going to give you, I guess I went through this, a summary and then tell you where we're at and then how we're going forward. Okay, so if you recall, this was something that was started really about halfway through the strategic planning process when the potential of leaving the campus became a possibility. We were approached by the Downtown Association and the chamber to talk about what would take our place if we were to leave. So we started out by getting an interlocal agreement together with the Port of Chelan County and the City of Wenatchee to start a redevelopment planning process. We hired a consultant, Collins Warman, that they do a lot of this redevelopment and development planning. We held several stakeholder meetings. We had a focus group that helped drive those meetings and bring to us what the community thought was the best use of the property. We received quite a bit of public input, and just before COVID hit us, we published the development plan. It was actually adopted by the commission in the early part of the COVID time, and then we kind of sat on it for a little bit because we didn't know what the economics that were surrounding the assumptions made in that plan were going to what was going to happen to those relative to COVID. So we kind of sat on it for a little bit, but then as we moved forward, we decided to work with Chelan Douglas Regional Port to conduct an RFP. So we had an interlocal with them, and then we issued that RFP on March 3rd of this year, and we opened four proposals on May 20th. And I'll take you through what those four proposals look like. So the first one is it's called 5th and Ave. It's submitted by Sadie B. and Ben Payne, their Wenatchee group. This facility that they're proposing would have improvements to the site of a new building for a YMCA and a 40-unit multi-residential. It's like two buildings, if you see those kind of in the back of the building. They would reuse, redevelop the headquarters building, and they would use the Fish and Wildlife building, and both of those would have new uses, including YMCA and the current building, a restaurant, and some offices, healthcare, and other administrative spaces in the headquarters building. And then North 40 Productions, a local media production company, would be in that Fish and Wildlife building.
Dan, may I ask, didn't they also propose to utilize the parking space for the theater?
Yeah, so their proposal included a shared parking agreement with the theater?
Yeah.
Yes, that is correct.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And I like the way you phrased it better than the way I phrased it. Thank you.
You bet. So this is a plan view of their proposal. You can see buildings one is the new YMCA. The buildings at three are the multi-use or multi-residential, excuse me. Building two is the current footprint of the headquarters redeveloped, and then four is the Fish and Wildlife building, and that parking lot that Commissioner Bowles referred to is right out in front of there. The second proposal was from Equity Capital, and it was a joint proposal from Equity Capital and Kidder Matthews. They're out of Seattle. They also have a new YMCA facility, although they had less detail around what was the size of the facility. In fact, if I want to go to the next slide there, actually it's a better shot of what their proposal is. They also propose a 105-unit multi-residential and proposed hotel where our park currently is and a reuse of the existing office building and quite a bit of on-site parking. They did not propose a shared parking arrangement with the theater. They would like to see the theater use adjacent parking. The next one is another joint proposal from GTS, Avara, and Grambaba. You may have heard the Grambaba name before. They've done quite a bit in Wenatchee, working with the city of Wenatchee and others. And so they've worked with the port on their some of their redevelopment down on Fifth Street. So they had kind of a good flavor of what we were looking for here. They proposed four new buildings. The YMCA building, they show it's slightly larger at 73,000 square feet, 100-plus unit multi-residential, 240,000 square feet of new mixed-use office, and a 3,000 square foot cafe. This is the most intense proposal we have in terms of the use on site. They also did propose to redevelop the current headquarters building and to reuse and expand the tech shop building into a mixed-use office building. It's quite an ambitious plan. It's got quite a bit of consistency with what the community vision was. You can kind of see how the site...
Dan, that there was a term in there that I've heard used before, but I'd like to have a definition. Adaptive reuse?
Yes. So adaptive reuse is where you take an existing building and try to not change it, especially from its appearance. Use the building in substantially the same structural state it was in. So adaptive reuse is very common in a downtown area where you have these really nice brick buildings, but the inside just doesn't have the infrastructure. So they'll come back in and reimagine the whole inside of the building, but they'll make the outside kind of look the same and keep the structure there.
Okay, thank you.
You bet.
Dan, do they have a proposal for parking?
Their proposal was to move the playhouse entrance to the south and utilize the city's parking for that. This proposal has quite a bit of underground parking on it.
Thank you.
Yeah, so you don't see all that surface.
I just
parking.
Wasn't seeing any parking lot, so it's under the buildings.
That is correct. Under several of the buildings would be parking.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Thanks.
Yeah. When they go to that dense of a development, that intense of a development, you have to kind of drive parking underground or into structures. So. The final one was Steinhauer Properties. They're out of Bellevue, Washington. They have the let's start from scratch kind of proposal. They want to demolish all the buildings on site and start over with a reimagined site. They actually do keep the central parkway that we kind of have now for circulation and was shown in our plans, the redevelopment plan, to keep that circulation through the middle of the site and connect it back with Columbia Street and 2nd Street with the city's existing streets. Theirs has basically four new buildings and a proposed fifth for a next phase, a YMCA facility, 172-unit multi-residential, 211 rooms of upscale hotel, some indoor-outdoor dining and makerspace, and then they show a phase two. If you look on the back of the, kind of along the railroad tracks where the parking lot and trees are, they propose that as a second phase of office mixed use. So, if you go to the next slide.
Okay, Dan, once again, back to terminology.
Oh, I'm sorry.
What is a makerspace?
Oh, I'm sorry. I dropped one in there. So makerspace is it's kind of a shared use space. So you've seen shared office spaces become quite popular recently where people can drop in and use a desk and a printer. Makerspace is similar, but it's with equipment, say a 3D printer or a metal lathe or other kind of hands-on type equipment that people that do small-scale either manufacturing or small-scale crafts even can use this space. So it's very popular in urban areas to make some makerspace, they call it. Thanks for reminding me of terminology. So this one, again, you see the road going through the middle of the property. It has really good circulation, has a nice connection to the existing city use to the south, and includes the YMCA, multifamily, and hotel, all of which were part of the recommended redevelopment plan, kind of a mixed use versus a single type of use.
So, Dan, may I ask a question, please?
Of course.
Every plan has the YMCA in it.
It does.
Has the YMCA stated a preferable size and square footage? Because I'm seeing 43,000 to 70,000 significant differential. Mm-hmm. Adequate, inadequate, more than adequate.
So I think the reason for the differential is depending on the use of other buildings on the site. So we have met with the YMCA and they have had an architect on board. They've scoped out what they need, but they would like to have not just the new YMCA recreational building that we're showing in these, but they'd also need some early childhood learning space. And so some of the developers put that space in the existing buildings, at the existing headquarter building. And I think some have incorporated into the YMCA, so they're not separated from that use. So the building can be larger for that. And I know they're talking with other entities that may be interested in being in that building. I think that's why we see the variation in size. And
okay, thank you.
Okay, so we're in the evaluation process right now. So
got one more question.
Oh, I didn't see that. Ann?
May I interrupt you, Dan?
Yes.
Yeah, hi. So what is the nature of the relationship or the business relationship between the YMCA and all of these different, businesses or corporations, whatever they are, that propose these plans?
Okay, so there's a difference between three of them and one of the proposers. With the Fifth and Ave proposal from Sadie B. and Ben Payne, they are listed in the proposal as part of the development team. So they have been working with that development group for well over a year, and so they're probably more informed about what their ideas are and what they need. The other three proposers were put in touch with the YMCA through the RFP process. The Y requested that all those on our plan holders list, all those that have requested information about the project, to be put in touch with the Y, as Music Theater of Wenatchee also requested, and we did provide that information for all of them. So they had the opportunity to work with them. The YMCA at this point is not telling us if there is a preference at any of them, because some of them, frankly, have not had a long-term interaction with the YMCA, so they don't know exactly what the plans are going forward. But they know that a community type services like the YMCA was a very high priority in the visioning document. And so they, I think all the developers saw an opportunity to really hit on something that was important for the community and something that they thought was a good fit for their development. So kind of depends on. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, I think it depends. There's a different level of interaction that's occurred between each of the developers and the YMCA at this point.
Okay, yeah. Well, that's exciting. I'm really, really happy to see that the YMCA is rolled into every single one of these proposals. Do we know anything about the nature of the financial relationship and how the YMCA proposes to get involved financially?
We don't know a lot at this point in time. Some of them do refer to the Y has requested a donation of the property. It's in their proposal that they've noted that. So I think it depends on, as we move forward with either selecting A or multiple developers, the Y to continue that relationship to kind of figure out what the financial ask is going to be of the Y to participate in the redevelopment.
Good. Okay. Thank you.
You bet. Okay, I'll move on to evaluation and next steps. So right now, the team, and just to remind you who the team is the City of Wenatchee, the Port Authority, the PUD, the Chamber of Commerce, and the Wenatchee Downtown Association. We're the evaluation team. We've gone through one meeting. We sat down and went through all the proposals and kind of came up with some questions and things we're just overall kind of high level what we're thinking about. And so we'll be meeting again next week to really do a hard ranking of the proposals and come up with a recommendation for moving forward, and that'll come to the commission. The qualifications that we're looking at, or the evaluation criteria we're looking at, really look at the team and their proposal. So, of course, I spun off there. So the team qualifications, so it's basically what the team has done in the past, similar projects, scope and scale. We look at what the vision was. So we gave them a very nice document to give us an idea give proposers an idea of what we would like to see, what the community would like to see on the site. And so some of it is consistency with that vision, and also support of existing uses like Music Theater of Wenatchee and other downtown uses. The ability for the proposer to actually pull this off financially, so what level of financial investment, what price are they offering for the property, the feasibility of what they're proposing, and the community benefit, so things like public services, and what would the community see on this site that we don't currently have or would be more accessible maybe on this site. And then some other things thrown in there, like sustainability, like job creation. I think those are all things we'd like to be able to support. So those are the criteria around which the evaluation team is going to make the recommendation. So, like I said, we're in our proposal evaluation process. We'll be coming to the board on June 20th with a selection team recommendation. And then we'll open up kind of a public comment period from that day until and through the next board meeting on July 5th to receive public input. We would then be coming to the board on July 18th to request action on that recommendation. And depending on what that recommendation is, we'd either continue to evaluate if it's a shortlist recommendation or right into negotiation if we think there's a single developer that should be moving forward at that point. We look for a board decision. We'd probably come in sometime late in the year, fall, for a board decision to enter into a development agreement and a purchase and sale agreement. So that's kind of the process we're going through right now, and where we'll be going. Any questions?
Go ahead, Gary.
Thank you, Steve. Good presentation, Dan. Appreciate it. As I looked over the various proposals, it was really difficult to determine those that offered some kind of housing, which ones were apartments, and I really didn't see any specific comment that indicated they'd be condos. And the reason I ask is I've had a number of people from the downtown area inquiring about condos and having more of a permanent residence in order to utilize their businesses downtown. That seemed to have a lot of strength and a lot of support downtown. Did any of these actually specifically say they were going to use condos versus apartments?
Nobody did say that, because they showed ownership being, you know, carved off not into an association but into a simple ownership of the parcel. So condo usually creates a condo association. But we did actually look at that a little bit through our assessment back in 2019 and early 2020, and it kind of depended on what the market was doing. So the condo market in Wenatchee took a big hit several years ago, but we think has quite a bit rebounded. We have heard that people do want to be able to have something stable. So that's probably one of the questions we'll be coming back to all of developers with, is to help us understand and flesh out some of these things they propose. Like, are any of those condo units, are they just purely apartment buildings? But there's quite a few questions that the team developed during our first conversation that we want the developers to more fully answer.
Yeah, thank you. I think if we took a survey amongst the downtown business owners, you might find quite a bit of strength for more of a permanent resident kind of condo application. But thank you. Appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Dennis?
Yeah, Dan, when the committees come together and make a recommendation, is it one and done, or are they going to be rank ordered? They come with a singular and the board doesn't like it, do we start over? So can you help me with that part of the process?
Absolutely. So not one and done. It would absolutely be a ranked order. I think through our early conversations, we have some strong proposals here. And so I think we would provide a recommendation and why we think that is the recommendation. But this is not like a process for a bid. This is a advisory process. The board is open to any kind of direction, recommendation, go back and ask more questions. We want to be very transparent in how we go through this process, so the board has every opportunity to ask more questions and make decisions that are conducive to that process.
Thank you so much.
You bet.
Any other questions, comments for Mr. Dan? All right, Dan. Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Look forward to ongoing information.
We'll be back a few times.
Thanks, Dan.
Very good.
Thank you.
All right. We do have Rob Davis with us. So, Rob, we'll circle back to the interconnection agreement.
Thanks, Kirk. Hello again, commissioners. Rob Davis, staff attorney here at the district, and Rand Chad Bowman back with me for another transmission-related topic. So I might want to get back in the good graces of whoever sets these agendas so you don't have so much transmission squished into one day. We are going from the general this morning to something more specific this afternoon. A little bit of a refresher. Commission approved template interconnection agreements last summer, which were then rolled into the adoption of our transmission tariffs. So they're a component of that. And at the time, we had a bit of a queue and some folks in study, and we knew that we would have potential for someone asking to actually interconnect to our system, and we're getting closer to that point. So we're coming with an update this week, and we'll be back next week to talk to you about approving an interconnection agreement. I'll get into more of why we're taking this this approach, but first wanted to start with a little bit of a background reminder of how we got to where we are. So we looked at, along with our transmission tariff for the interconnection agreements, using the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's interconnection agreement as a starting point. And so we adopted that to our needs for generators, and then we further adopted it to our needs for large loads. So we knew that whether we had a large load or a large generator connecting to our system, that we'd want to have some standard process in place. And in going through that, we tried to identify what specific things does a large load need that is different from a generator. And in this agreement, we only address the requirements for interconnecting to our system. So this is really just the technical requirements, the assignment of obligations for interconnecting. Transmission service itself is handled under a separate study and agreement process. And then if the large load is taking power from us, under a third leg of the stool, if you will, for the power sales. And this isn't unlike how we worked with Alcoa for their facility. There was an interconnection agreement and a transmission agreement and a power sales agreement. And so for new interconnecting customers, it'd be the same approach. We have the interconnection, which is what we're here talking about today. Transmission service is handled separately, and so is power. So just wanted to make sure everyone understood. We're only talking about one facet of the program today. And you'll see there on the slide that what we're actually even further drilling down discussing are some customer-specific requests to modify the template. So we started with the template agreement. And of course, every customer is going to have a different setup. So we are in some negotiations and have had some requests that deviate from the template that we think are beneficial to us, that the customer thinks is beneficial to them. So we're looking at as things staff would propose as good changes to make for this interconnection. And just to be more specific, the interconnecting customer is the Microsoft Corporation. We've been studying a data center here in the county. Probably remember the ports meeting about land acquisition there. So probably not a terrible surprise, but did want to note that this is the customer we are in discussions with and hope to have a final agreement for you to see at the next board meeting. So, Rebecca, we can move to the next slide and get into the specifics. So the primary requested change from the template relates to funding for the project. So if you remember, the interconnection customer is required to pay for and construct the facilities that they own. They're required to pay for the facilities, the interconnection facilities that we will own, even though we will construct them, and also for any upgrades to the transmission system that are required to support them interconnecting. So all those things are customer funded, and the template approach is for study deposits that were unused to roll forward, additional deposits to be made, security to be posted, and then monthly invoicing to the customer with monthly payments of amounts as they are expended. And this customer has requested a different approach where we set, based on a good faith estimate, a not to exceed amount, and that those costs would be paid up front instead of as they're expended. And so the approach we're considering is that there would be an initial payment to cover some upfront things, particularly around procurement, so that we can avoid schedule hiccups down the road and also lock in prices for some of the more expensive equipment. And so after that initial payment, we would begin that activity with the remainder payment made later on with a little bit of overlap, so we don't exhaust the first payment and find ourselves having to stop and wait while invoices and payments go back and forth. So a couple of large tranches. This allows the customer to avoid the security requirement because we would be receiving the money up front. They have a very good credit rating, and so we're able to consider this. We have included, as I mentioned, it's a good faith estimate, but it's pretty extensive. So it includes contingency, it includes ancillary costs like taxes and things like that to make sure that we are going to be, as the interconnection template contemplates, that this still is a customer-funded project and we're not shifting costs to pre-existing customers. We've also set in for that global total amount regular check-ins so that, as we're spending funds, we make sure that we are on track with what we expect to spend, that we're not burning through faster than was planned, and we are required to meet, make sure everyone's on the same page, and it gives us an opportunity to request additional funding in a timely manner if the original not-to-exceed amount is coming up short, so that we can go back, they can work through their process, we can make sure to amend what we're calling the not-to-exceed amount, again, so that we can avoid schedule issues and keep the project moving. And then finally, if for some reason, as I mentioned, they have very good credit, but if for some reason the credit situation was to change and there is a significant downgrade below a set threshold, we have the option to revert to our funding process that's in the template so that we could return any funds that we are still holding and hadn't expended and go back to a billing on monthly basis with security in place. So with all of those things, we think it's beneficial from a certainty and schedule position to do the upfront funding, that we have addressed things that might otherwise create a cost shift, and that way we can satisfy both sides of the contract and both sets of parties and move forward in a beneficial manner. We have some other differences from the template that have been requested, and some of these are not really major, but we wanted to highlight them for you for information's sake. We have an explicit acknowledgement of retail service, and what that means is when we set up the template, we weren't sure what sorts of customers we were going to get, what their stance would be on taking power from us, taking power from others, what sorts of arrangements they might have, and we left some flexibility in the contract that we could provide interconnection and then have a large load customer that was like all other customers in the county as far as being served by us, or that if we had a very large, very sophisticated customer, we'd have the option to consider whether we wanted to just provide a wire service and let them purchase power from a third-party provider and use our transmission system to deliver it to their point of interconnection. So we didn't want to lock ourselves into any particular direction. We left ourselves that flexibility, but in discussions with this customer, we want to move forward with them as a retail customer of the district. What that means for us is that their transmission service will be included as one of the services under their Schedule 4 contract, and also it gives us some certainty around regulatory requirements for this customer. So things like renewable portfolio standards, renewable energy credits under the Clean Energy Transformation Act, if we had resource adequacy requirements, all of those things will be things that we will provide and include is part of the services under the power services agreement under rate schedule 4. So that's the benefit to us, or the certainty that we get from locking that down here. We simplified some of the milestones in the contract and simplified some of the conditions to start work. These were largely lessons learned. Again, we modified a template that was intended for interconnecting generation to interconnecting loads. And so some of the things that a generator needs to do just weren't applicable. So we pulled those out and tried to condense notifications and scheduling around that. We clarified some cost responsibility for modifications. And this is, you know, through the study process, we've developed a plan of service. And that, as we're going through, we'll have its own minor things that have to change. But this is really around large modifications. Either, for example, the customer wants to make a big change to their facility, or we make a big change to our system that impacts how they connect. That those things that are outside the plan of service, there wasn't a lot of clarity in the template we discovered about who was responsible for cost. So then that has now been allocated properly. And then there were other provisions that we discovered just weren't applicable to a large load. And so throughout, we went ahead and removed those. For example, things like balancing area, compliance requirements. So some lessons learned, some things that we discovered going through that we were able to fine tune. Looks like we have a question from Commissioner Congdon.
You're on mute, Commissioner.
There we go. Yeah, thanks. So, Rob, will you go back one page? I have a question. Sure. I think it's one page back. On the interconnection agreement, the not to exceed amount includes contingency and ancillary costs. Here it is. I just had a question about the not to exceed amount and how comfortable we are with that.
Sure. We have discussed it quite a bit, knowing that having a set amount as opposed to billing for costs that are incurred, that we want to make sure it's a good number. So we did take the numbers we got out of HDR. We made sure that we did have related costs like taxes in there, and that we built a comfortable contingency in. And on top of that, knowing that even then we can't, we don't have perfect foresight. So we also built in a provision that if we get through these check-ins and we still haven't, you know, we see coming down the pike that we are on pace to exceed that amount, we do have an ability to stop what we're doing so that we aren't taking on costs beyond what was put in there. So it is a not to exceed amount, but it's probably better described as a not to exceed until authorized further. It's built Perfect. To go back and get more if we need to. But looking at what we've done, we really hope we're not going to get there.
Yeah, that's what I was looking for. That's great. I'm happy to hear that. I mean, with who we're dealing with, we have to, oh my gosh, cross every T and dot every I. So that sounds good. Thank you.
Sure. Any other questions on that or other modifications that we've done? So as I mentioned, we'll be coming back. Our plan is to come back to the June 20th meeting. And specifically in the resolution adopting the interconnection agreements, there was authority for the GM to execute agreements that were substantially similar in form and format to the template. But we recognize this funding deviation is material. It's something we see staff sees as a beneficial provision for both sides. But we do recognize that it's beyond what is in the template. So we will be coming back for affirmative approval of the final agreement, and then we will be coming back again. Couldn't give you a timeline, but recognizing that we've identified things that we think are good for the load template. Going forward, things that we can make clearer so that if we have another customer who perusing this template on our website that we've got the best information out there in the most up-to-date version. So we'll consolidate lessons learned from this and bring a proposed revision to the template to discuss with the board as well.
All right. Thank you, Rob. Anything else?
That's all I have. Thank you for your time.
I would just want to reiterate the first bullet on that last slide. Just the June 20th date is very important to the customer in terms of their fiscal year and the project timelines. Thanks,
Thank
Rob.
For that reminder.
Thank you, Rob. Looks like we got another question.
Gary?
Actually, just more of a comment. Rob, thank you for that report. This is an extremely complex matter, and you've been able to present it in a way that you simplify it for a neophyte like me to understand. So thank you very much. I understand the magnitude of this issue as well. So I am comforted by the fact knowing that you are spearheading this, Rob. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate that.
Okay.
Oh, looks like another comment or question.
Oh, Ann?
Yeah, Steve. Just a thought that you might ask if any of our guests have any questions, because they are certainly within their right to step up and ask questions.
Perfect. So I'll just go ahead and open that up.
Yes, as a matter of fact, thank you, Anne, for that. Steve, if you don't mind, I'm just curious on the last conversation. What is the benefit of entertaining the new contract with Microsoft with a not to exceed as opposed to leaving things as they are, given that we're putting in safeguards to protect ourselves? It feels almost like a have your cake and eat it too type of contract. So I'm just trying to understand what's to be gained by doing a modification. Is it Microsoft is coming to the table wanting some changes?
Rob, you want to take that one?
That certainly. So that is part of it. Beneficial to them in the sense that not having to post, for example, a letter of credit provides some cost benefit to them. For us, it's a certainty benefit. So having cash in hand before we make expenditures is, always less risky than sending the invoice, making sure it gets paid. If it's not, sending a late notice. If it's still not, trying to make collection activities. So it's a little bit more certain. The end result is going to be the same, that everything is paid for by the interconnection customer. There's a true-up at the end, which would happen whether we were doing monthly billing or upfront billing. So it started as a customer request, which we wanted to entertain as a good partner. We saw some benefit to us and move forward with that.
Thank you.
I don't have a question. I just have a comment. And I'm sorry, I've not been able to get my camera to work. It was probably something I did initially when I got into Teams. But I just wanted to say that I appreciate the work on the agreement, because I think it's important to write down the process. I think if you have the process, then everybody knows where they stand and what the agreement is. And you can have your cake and eat it too. I guess this is what we're looking at. But I think it's important for clarification. And I'm certain that, the attorney was involved in, making sure that the agreement was binding, not only on our part, but Microsoft's part, or any other large load customers that may want the utilities.
Thank you, Aurora. Anyone else? All right. Rob, we look forward to hearing back from you at our next meeting, and we are aware of that June 20th deadline, you know, date. We can't go beyond that. We know we've got to be moving right along, so we'll do our part as well. So thank you, Rob.
Thank you.
Ready to move on?
Ready to head into the resolutions.
Oh, we've got one more item from the morning.
What? Which one's that?
The Confluence Parkway due diligence. Jeez.
You're right.
So this is item number 10, Confluence Parkway due diligence. It's an item that's on every board meeting while we're going through the process that the PUD is taking part of. And with us is Michelle Smith.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you, Kirk. Commissioners, I wanted to just briefly recap a recent site visit that we had, I guess, over a little week, little over a week ago now, to the Confluence State Park and Horan Natural Area with our noise consultant, Will Packard, and project manager James Kapla of Jacobs Engineering. There's no action required today. I just wanted to keep this very short and hopefully maybe give a little bit of time for the commissioners that were able to attend segments of that site visit, an opportunity to provide a little bit of their feedback on that visit. Slide two, Rebecca, thank you. So I briefly went over just a few of the highlights of this on this slide. And I think, again, having us all in person with the consultant was very helpful. They actually had a noise meter with them, so we were able to witness firsthand kind of what sound and noise sounds like out there and really understand a little bit better about how the noise study works, and basically helped us to, you know, look at how the modeling, how and talk about how the noise meter and how that goes into a model, and then how this kind of spits out, I guess, if you will, the types of noise, expected noise impacts they predict with a 30-mile-an-hour roadway and the number of cars and the types of vehicles they expect to be on that roadway. So we did find out that engine and exhaust noise is included in the noise modeling. We also talked about the mitigation that they're proposing. We talked about the berms and the vegetation. Again, you know, the purpose of this noise evaluation and study that we're doing is to really review the mitigation that's being proposed, look and make sure if there's anything else that, you know, that we want to look at or have the city add on to that. And so we're hoping to, you know, at the end of this, when I come back with that report in July, we'll get a better sense if the assumptions were all correct and if there's anything more that maybe we want to ask for in terms of mitigation here. Right. But in terms of the site visit, I think as we were out there, we actually came up with some other things that we wanted to just make sure to remember to talk to the city about. Those on this list are 6, 7, and 8, which is more around the entrance, the actual bridge design itself, and perhaps asking for some artistic additions that could help create a better aesthetic in that area. And then also just really an acknowledgement, again, that once the pedestrian bridge is removed, that the entire new pedestrian bridge that will be attached to the roadway will all be owned by the city and will no longer be a PUD obligation. So those are some important things that we just thought to highlight as we were talking out there. Number five, I want to touch on that one. So as the Federal Highway looks at what they will be able to fund and what the thresholds are for noise impacts and the types of mitigation, they're putting the types of areas are put into category in different categories. Category A, as an example, is really for is very rare, I guess, and is maintained for areas that are supposed to be very, very quiet and where that preservation of that reduced noise, and the quiet is so important to really maintain the uses for that area. So the example, and how rare this is the Arlington Cemetery is a Category A. The noise study, and originally DOT and the city have proposed that the Horan area, so again, not the part where the roadway is going to be, but the actual Horan natural area closer towards the Columbia there, that inner area is currently written down as a Category A area. And so we talked about how important that will be to make sure that as Federal Highway reviews that Category A, that we hope that, because ultimately it's their decision on what category it should be, that we hope that they maintain it as a Category A, because that helps protect that natural area into the future should there ever be changes to the roadway or any other thing that's adjacent to that park. It can help us protect that as a natural area under our FERC license. So though I wanted to just touch on those things and then pause and let any of the commissioners add any feedback that attended that they would like to add to that.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. Michelle, I just have a quick question before you go to the commissioners who were able to attend. So I think you said that it is our hope that this is maintained as a Category A. Is that not our decision? And, well, FERC has said, or is this highway categorization?
That's a great question.
It should be up to us as to what that category is, and it is up to us to maintain it. So, yeah, I that's my question. I don't know. Who designated it, and how does that get done?
That's a great question. It really is. So that the categories are decided by Federal Highway. That it's under their process, and it is not something that DOT or even Chelan PD has. We don't have the decision authority. It's Federal Highway that makes that decision, and they make that decision because it determines the type of place and what the thresholds are for noise. So the mm-hmm. park, like the rest of Confluence Park, is a Category C, which incorporates a park area. Category A is normally held for cemeteries and other areas that where extreme quiet it needs to be preserved. So it's pretty rare is what we're understanding. But it is a Federal Highway decision. And it was decided early on, and in fact, the noise study even designates this as a proposed Category A. But ultimately, the way we understand it, an application has to go to Federal Highway from DOT, that they have to fill out a bunch of information on why they're proposing it as Category A, and then it's Federal Highway that makes that decision.
So I guess I don't quite understand. You probably did a great job of explaining it, but so it's been designated Category A, but then as maybe new uses develop, then they have to look at it again and recategorize it?
Yeah, I misspoke. It has not been designated as Category A yet. It is being proposed and written into the NEPA documents as a proposed Category A. So it has not been officially designated. I misspoke. I'm sorry.
Oh, I don't think you did, but anyway, I probably misheard. But it is proposed by the Highway Department at this time to be a Category A.
It's being proposed by DOT and the city. It's being discussed as a Category A. We all believe that it should be Category A. So now it needs to go forward to Federal Highway to make the final decision.
Oh, that's interesting, because those standards are high. Mm-hmm. That's a high bar.
But the other good thing that we've realized is that the Horan Natural Area and the impacts in that, again, that inner area where the natural trails are and such, the noise increases that came out of the study are not that high. So in that area,
they get higher, right, as you get closer to the roadway, and that's where a lot of the mitigation is proposed to reduce the noise, as you know, for the loop trail. But the more dirt trails and that inner part of the Horan Natural Area, the noise study report did demonstrate that the noise increases because of the highway will be pretty small in that area. So even if it's Category A today, and if for some reason they don't, you know, maybe a federal highway doesn't agree that it's Category A, and they say, no, it's more like a park and it should be Category C, it probably won't impact the decisions and the types of mitigation we're doing today for the parkway. But where we think it is critical is to protect us for the future. Because if for some reason the roadway needs to be expanded because there's more, you know, in 10, 20 years that they feel like it needs to be widened or second story, or, we don't know, right? But if there's any other adjacent things that happen, it kind of protects us for the future so that it can always, you know, be relate, you know, categorized as that in this process, which will carry out into future processes as well.
Yeah, that's good. So, but that sound study, the noise levels were based on tire noise only.
Right? It did include. We found out that the way the model works is that it does include engine noise and exhaust noise. So depending on the truck, you know, the heights, it does project that there's going to be a certain percentage of trucks and a certain percentage of vehicles and in different truck sizes. And all of that is in the model, we found out. So that was really good clarification for us.
That is good. So, but it did show an increase in all areas, some higher than others.
And in the Horan Natural Area, luckily, it's a very, very small increase. So we felt fairly comfortable that along with the mitigation, that will even reduce it more. So we're feeling a little bit more comfortable that the Horan Natural Area from a noise perspective with the mitigation and possibly some even additional mitigation that we might propose will protect that Horan Natural Area. So we're still not all the way there yet, but we're feeling a little more comfortable that we can get there.
Thank you. Those are good questions, Ann, and just from my perspective, I really am very appreciative of my fellow commissioners continuing to push for our own noise consultant, because it did the things that Michelle's talking about. It confirms, it confirmed that it was a pretty good study. But it gave us more information than what was shared to us previously, and that it did encompass all the different components of sound, not just the road noise. That it does reinforce the fact that, we started talking about this Category A, and we talked about with having our own consultant really focusing on what we want mitigated properly. I just walked away, and I'm just speaking on for myself, much, much more comfortable that we're going to have good information and really work hard to mitigate the areas of concerns that we have. And so, Gary and I think it was Randy that was there. If you could share any of your thoughts on it, but those were my takeaways.
Steve, if I may, my understanding of the other components being considered, engine and exhaust, was a study of studies, not an actual measurement. Applied to that, taken on that exact situation. And what we're asking Jacobs Engineering to do is to do actual measured sound studies on site. Is that correct?
Well, Michelle, maybe you could correct that for me, but my understanding is that the work, those additional components were done. We just didn't know that, and that it was a fairly good study. So it's, I think we walked away feeling that the work that the city did was good work. We just didn't get all that information, and that is part of the original study.
Yeah, that was a good answer, Commissioner. It is. We talked about possibly whether it was needed, I guess, or possibly doing some additional noise metering. We did talk about that with the consultant, and we talked about it when we were out there as well. Their feeling right now is that the city did, and their I shouldn't say the city, their consultant, he did a good job with the study they did. And basically the way it works is they go out and they put, you know, literally hundreds of these noise meters all over the place and took levels of existing noise over a 2-day period. And so you have nighttime noise, you know, rush hour noise, you have all these varying time frames. And they use what they call that existing information, and then they put it into the model. And then they, into the model, they put all the assumptions, right, about what they're going to project in terms of the number of vehicles and the distances and all of that. And the vehicle types, which we just talked about, we learned that it does include exhaust and more than just, you know, tire to pavement. And then it's the way this model works is then it projects out the increase in what the you know, expected increase in noise decibels will be. And so what we decided is, and when we were out there, we were actually reading, Commissioner Arsenal had an app on his phone to measure noise, and then we had our consultants with an actual, you know, a couple $1,000 noise meter with them, and they were a little bit different, but we got a real sense that, you know, just being out there on a fairly quiet day, it was 40, I think our noise decibels were in the 40s, so it gave us a better idea of when we were looking at these noise measurements, what we were actually what they mean. It's just so hard to imagine when someone says, oh, it's 56 decibels. You know, you're like, well, what does that relate to? And then noise is different for everybody, right? So I think what we decided is that it makes sense to look at all the assumptions that were used in the noise study, you know, have our consultant go through the, you know, and help communicate to us all of these assumptions and validate for us that yes, it was done according to, you know, all of the right requirements and standards. And then they're really, what I'm finding is our consultants are really good at communicating the results. And I think that's what we were missing a little bit, is just this really way to tell us, here's what we're seeing, here's what the mitigation, and then here's some things you might want to think about asking for that might be above and beyond, or maybe even a little bit more than just saying we're going to put vegetation on top of a berm. Maybe there's a little more detail that we should be asking for to make sure that that area is preserved. So that was a long-winded, I'm sorry, but I just wanted to explain that we decided that we didn't have to go out there and start from the very basic, taking more meter readings of existing conditions.
So Dennis, great question. And Michelle, I appreciate that answer, but just to reinforce, and Gary and Randy, please tell me if you heard the same thing, that really what this, having our noise consultant, is going to do for us is to really make sure that what needs to be mitigated can be mitigated to the fullest extent that that's possible. And I didn't realize that without this classification, without really doing this extra work, you know, we may not be getting as much it is limited what you can have the funding pay for, but let's make sure that we're doing the best mitigation possible that's available. And that's what I came away feeling. Wow, I'm really glad Gary and others have been pushing for this noise study, because we confirmed that there was good data there, but we've got somebody on our side pushing to get the best mitigation possible that we want, so, or that we need. And Gary?
Thank you, Steve. And since I was sort of the culprit behind the noise study, I want to fess up that there was a misunderstanding, miscommunication, or I should maybe point out later clarification. After the conversation with the city's noise engineer, but during my conversation on the phone with the city's noise engineer, and Michelle Smith was on that call with me, I did ask the question specifically, does this include exhaust noise? And I was thinking of things like Harley motorcycles and big delivery trucks and things like that. And this is where the miscommunication came in, was that I heard him to say no. Mm-hmm. And then my second question to him was, do you mean to tell me that every car on this roadway will be classified as a Tesla? And my understanding was he said yes. So there were two questions there that there was a misunderstanding on. And that is really what prompted the request for the noise study, to create more of a realistic world. Now, in the noise study, as has been said, there were criteria and assumptions made. And based on that criteria and assumptions, it arrived at a conclusion. So one of the assumptions is that there will be no more than 20% of the traffic that will be trucks or big vehicles. So whether or not that's accurate, we don't know. If you complete the parkway and then go stand on it in 3 years from now, the noise might exceed what is projected to exceed if the traffic makeup is different than the basis of the assumption. So there are things that we have to kind of roll with. Our guys, our noise study folks that we hired, provide a great value, great insight. And one of the things, as Steve mentioned, that I was also unaware of, is that the federal funding component of the parkway construction prohibits spending on certain types of mitigation. Not only does it prohibit spending federal dollars or city dollars, it would prohibit the PUD spending additional money of its own dollars to do mitigation. So it creates bookends that are a take it or leave it. It's not as if we have negotiating room to build the berm higher if there's not dollars to do so, or if it doesn't fit the federal criteria. So these all things that we would not have learned had it not been for we personally hiring a noise study engineering firm who was able to do this for us. Secondly, it has been said, and it's true, other than in the photographs you see there with his noise meter, they did not go back out into the Haran wetlands and put noise sensors and redo the city's noise study. They validated what the city's noise study was. And that's to your question, Dennis. There was a validation of the noise study. We did not recreate the city's noise study, if that's helpful. I just wanted to bring it into the conversation. Bad on me for initially misunderstanding the answers that were given to me by the city's engineer, and I think Michelle can kind of validate, since she took notes, that those were indeed the answers that were given. But we arrived at a conclusion that I think is acceptable. Thank you.
Randy?
You bet. First, I want to thank staff for getting us all out there on the
the walkway with them so they could explain things as we're walking along. That was incredibly helpful for me. I came away from that hour out there with a variety of thoughts. One being convinced that the wildlife is going to be protected as well as we can protect it. And two, and that this is something we haven't talked about, trail life for the humans was going to be incredibly enhanced with this change. And it's not only the fact that the trail will be moving off of Holly Street, it's there's another section of the trail that right now runs right beside the railroad tracks. So we're moving off of Holly Street and off the railroad tracks, that trail coming around through other property, and even down toward the Wenatchee River, the trail is going to be moved further away from the railroad tracks. Yes, there'll be a parkway there, but there's, I guess what I'm saying is I came away thoroughly convinced that the trade-offs can work well for the PUD. I don't know whether they will work well as a definitive statement, but I think they can work well for us in protecting the wildlife and enhancing people's recreation in that area. So thank you, Michelle, for having us out there. It was time well spent for me.
Great, thank you.
Just a little attempt at humor. In Rebecca's travel log with her son, their vacation, which I truly appreciated, I believe there's a photograph of a mama buffalo and a calf nursing in the middle of a highway. And, you know, we've got our tail wrapped around here in knots over this adaptation. And I'm looking at that buffalo and her calf thinking, you know, maybe the animals just know a whole lot more than we do. So, you know, we need to take it serious, but we need to be a little careful about taking ourselves way too seriously. But thanks for the photo. I found humor in that.
All right.
Looks like we got one more question or comment from Commissioner Congdon.
Yeah, thank you, Kurt. Gary, your information about the federal funding, that was very interesting. I didn't know that. I hadn't heard that. That's important for us to factor that in. And I just have a couple quick comments about the funding. I actually talked with a legislator who is on the Transportation Council, and he really enlightened me in terms of the funding for this project. We've been told that it's fully funded, that the $85 million is there, but according to actually two different legislators who are on that council, who have relationships, the project would qualify for the money, but there are no assurances. The money's not been earmarked for Parkway. It has not been allocated. So the only thing we know is that this project would likely qualify for that money. But beyond that, there's no commitment, no assurances that the money is there. So, you know, it's somewhat out of our purview. Well, it is but I just think it's important that we factor this in, because we're going to make the ultimate decision on no or go in terms of doing this land swap for our property. And their concern, my concern, is that a lot more dollars, a lot more work, engineering, design work, go into this, a lot more money spent on this with no assurance that the full funding is there. And by the way, I was asked to share this. So.
Good. Again, Michelle, you're doing a great job, and keep up the good work. And I like the direction that we're taking, and I appreciate Gary's hammering and Ann's hammering on the noise study, and I think we're providing our due diligence very well. Everybody's working really hard, and you know we're moving our due diligence forward. So thank you very much for doing that,
Michelle. I agree with you and appreciate the time today. Thank you.
I think Michelle had one more slide to go through on the timeline. Oh, Q&A. Thank you.
Okay, well, I'll go through these very quickly then. I've forgotten about these too. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. I just wanted to make sure that this update on the use of de-icer, if anyone had any questions on this, let me know. Basically, we know that the city uses sodium chloride, which is basically salt. They make it into a brine, and then it's sprayed onto the roads. We expect that that's what they will be using for this the parkway. We did confirm that with the city. And then also, you know, there's management practices for all of this. The browning of the trees is a whole study in itself. I guess there's been a lot of study on this. It's actually the browning of the needles and the vegetation as the salts are pulling moisture out of those, out of the needles, and kind of creates that browning effect. It especially happens on the passes or wherever you're going at higher rates of speed because it's splashing up, it's getting, you know, splashed up into the trees with vehicles and trucks. With a 30-mile-an-hour roadway, shouldn't be splashing up as much. I don't know if there's going to be other mitigation for that. But again, the vegetation and ensuring that it's not turning brown will not be a peak. That'll be, you know, we're going to maintain those areas. But the idea is that we will not own them. So all of that will be, you know, owned by the city of Wenatchee and not a PUD obligation, I guess, for the stuff that's being, you know, planted as within the berm areas to separate the roadway from the trail. And then the last one was just a reminder on the timeline. It's just a repeated slide, we hope to bring back our finalized noise report in July. So I think we're on a good course to make that happen, and we'll be back then with the report.
Great. Thank you, Michelle. Mm-hmm. Anything else? Kirk, at this time, I think I'll just open it up to public comment, see if anybody has anything. Just going back to the end of our agenda for the morning. Do we have anybody from the public that would like to make any comment at this time? Rebecca, are you seeing anything?
I do not see any digital or on-screen hands.
Okay. Kelly?
Yeah. Sorry, I was trying to get the reaction down. I just wanted to thank you guys. This has been a very fascinating process, and I appreciate you taking the time to answer the questions as we may or may not have them. Lots to get caught up on, so appreciate you all for all your hard work. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Welcome. Okay, Kirk, let's go ahead and move on into resolutions 14 and 15. Take it away.
Okay, we've already approved 15, so we'll just have 14.
Oh, that's right.
Resolution 14 is a resolution ratifying field work order change orders number 7 through 12 for the Service Center project with Absher Construction Company of Puyallup, Washington for construction of the General Contractor Construction Manager Contract number 18-91 for the Service Center project. And with us is David Lodge. Thanks, David.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. David Lodge, Project Management Manager. And I should warn you, while the other presenters were presenting, I continued to add detail to my presentation, so hopefully it didn't get too lengthy here. So as Kirk said, I'm here to present a resolution to ratify field work order change order 7 through 12. for the 1891 contract. And previously, change orders 1 and 2 were ratified on February 1st of 2021, along with execution of GMP 2 for construction. And change orders 3 through 6 were ratified on July 19th of last year, and the delegation authority limits were increased for the project. In the year since, fieldwork order change orders 7 through 12 have been executed in the amount of $821,355. A detailed list of changes and associated costs are included in the resolution and generally include value-added owner changes, design revisions, value engineering credits, and responding to unforeseen site conditions. I want to give some context to the design and owner changes. So as this is a GCCM contract, one of the many advantages is the ability to negotiate a price prior to final completion of the design. In the fall of 2020, bids for major trade packages were solicited using 90% documents. This allowed the district to secure pricing on as much scope as possible at a time of rapidly escalating costs. One area that had us particularly concerned was the price of steel, which would have dramatically affected the total construction cost had we waited any longer. But with using 90% documents, the project did anticipate there would be resulting changes from the strategy as well as typical construction changes, and included a project contingency of $5.2 million in the budget, or 5% of the guaranteed maximum price as required by RCW. To date, change orders 1 through 12 have been issued in the amount just under $1.4 million plus sales tax, and as a result, project contingency has been reduced to $3.7 million. Separately, costs arising from risks assigned to the contractor are funded from the contractor's contingency included in the guaranteed maximum price. The GMP included contractor's contingency account in the amount of $2.7 million. Contingency authorizations to date have been approved in the amount of $1.3 million, leaving a remaining balance of $1.4 million in the contractor's contingency account. The project anticipates future change orders for pending issues and through the course of the remaining work, and we will continue to manage within the delegated authority limits and will periodically request board action to ratify change orders as the project progresses. I had an hour to work on that, so I had a little bit of time.
Commissioners, any questions? All right. Do I have a motion to approve resolution number 14?
I would make such a motion.
Second.
Second.
Okay. All those in favor of resolution number 14 signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Resolution passes.
Thanks, David.
Manager.
Thank you.
Thanks, David. Kurt, manager items?
Yep. I've got two items. One, just and you mentioned it this morning, Commissioner McKenna, but I just wanted to mention in case anybody's listening in the afternoon and not the morning, just the plan to resume to in-person meetings on June 20th. We're looking forward to that. And then second, we've got John Wisniewski, who's with us to give us a Lake Chelan lake level update, given the quite unique year we've been having in terms of the amount of snow in the mountains and the cool, wet spring. So, John.
Thanks, Kirk. Good afternoon, Commissioners. John Wisniewski, an energy analyst within the Energy Planning and Trading Group. I'll give a quick overview. I know there have been a few email updates as well, just about lake levels to date, and then I'll talk a little bit about what happened over the weekend for a more recent update. So as Kirk mentioned, it's been a very cool spring. We had a healthy year for snowpack. We forecasted 90% of average on April 1st, but it was so cool that a lot of that snowpack stayed up in the mountains instead of melting off when it normally does. So it's been a bit of a later runoff. I know there's been some data and stats in the emails we've sent, but about 6 degrees below average temperatures in both April and May, which, again, slowed the refill of the lake. I'll point out this slide here was a screenshot of lake levels from our external website on last Thursday. And since that time, we did have some warmer weather over the weekend, as well as a bit of rain on snow that really picked up the runoff. So I think the freshet has begun. Just yesterday alone, the lake rose about half a foot in a single day. And the last week, it's up a little over 2 feet. And so I think it's looking much healthier in terms of lake levels, and we're transitioning to trying to fill the lake as quickly as possible. There were some discussions this morning amongst the lake level team, more towards how to manage that water just because of the later runoff. There's a little bit less room in the lake to absorb that runoff when it comes now. So we're starting to talk about the potential to spill for headwater control and other things as that lake starts to fill very quickly. But with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
I just want to jump in and say you guys are magicians. I don't know how you do it. I mean, this is such a challenging year. You have to get it up to, or we have to make an attempt to get it up to target levels, and yet we still have a lot of snow in the mountains, and you guys always manage to get us there, and I applaud you. It's amazing work you do. Thank you.
Thank you.
One of the questions that I have, John and Kirk, just communicating this with our customers up there, can someone just review with us what we've been doing to communicate the interesting path that on the lake refill?
John, you want to cover that, or do you want me to?
Sure, absolutely.
Oh, there's Rachel.
We did do, and I'll let Rachel correct anything I say or add as well, but we did do a press release on the 23rd, as well as a couple of radio interviews and then another interview with a local news source there. And I think it was actually pretty successful. We anticipated quite a few questions heading into Memorial Day weekend or phone calls, emails, anything else from the public. But we actually, to date, have only received two. So whether the cool weather kept folks away from the lake just because of the unusual weather we've been having, or the communications efforts were successful, probably a combination of the two. But we actually didn't receive the number of questions and inquiries that we expected, again, just due to the unusual year that we've had. And Rachel, you can feel free to add anything as needed.
Nothing to add. Thank you so much.
Great. Okay.
Thanks, John.
Anything else?
That's all I have for manager items.
All right. Commissioner Travel. Lisa there?
Yep, she's here with us.
How are you?
Good, Lisa. Thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here. So we have a travel coming up for APPA National Conference in Nashville for Commissioners Arsenault, Congdon, and Smith. They're all set to go.
Yes. I'll jump in. I thought I CC'd you, but I had to cancel my whole trip out. No penalties. Canceled the hotel. I made my plane reservation, and I canceled it, so I'm going to eat that one. I can't go because of my husband's he has an issue with a pinched nerve, so I'm a no on that.
Okay. Do you need me
you'll have
to cancel your registration?
Correct, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll have to do that. And if they ask, it's, you know, it's for medical reasons, not for me but for my husband.
Okay.
Thank you
for that.
Yeah, sorry, I thought I'd let you know and I didn't. My apologies.
That's okay. That's why we do this. Anything else for that? Good. I have Commissioner Congdon attending the water quality meeting later in the month virtually. We have Waputa Association meetings. We'll be in Wenatchee. Commissioner Arsenault, I canceled your previous hotel, so that's all set.
Thank you, Lisa.
You're welcome. Commissioner Smith will be traveling to Washington, D.C. July 19 through 21 for the Policymakers Council. You're all set for that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Commissioner McKenna, we'll have Energy Northwest coming up in July.
Lisa, I'm going to have to get back to you. I'm sure that's going to be in person, so we'll need to make some reservations for that.
Okay. Thank you. Then looks like we skip August and head into September WAPUTA meetings, middle of the month, and then another water workshop. Is anybody plan to attend those besides Commissioner Congdon? Someone going to slip in there?
The WAPUTA meetings, my plan is to attend most of them, if not all, going forward.
Even the water workshop?
Probably not the water workshop.
Okay.
Lisa, the water workshop this year is in Spokane at the Davenport.
Thank you.
And Lisa, I'll be attending that meeting.
Oh, okay. Great. Thank you. So I'll have Commissioner Arsenault and Commissioner Congdon. Okay.
That's probably good for today.
All right. Thank you. I'll get on those couple things and let me know if I can help with anything else.
Lisa, would you check with Susan at Energy Northwest on motel reservations for that meeting?
Yeah, I'll let her know that you plan to attend.
Great, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, follow-up on delegation of action items from previous board meetings.
Steve, we had commission items.
Oh, man, I'm just missing my items. Thank you, Gary. Commission items. I'm just moving through this agenda.
That's my fault. Do that if my fault.
It's easier if you skip them.
Okay.
So I've got something for commission items. I just want to get on everyone's radar screen. As president of WAPUTA this year, one of my missions and mandates was to visit every PUD in the state during my presidency. And in order to do that, I would like to get on your radar screen, each of my fellow commissioners, a date in the future. Rebecca and Steve will be working with you to determine what date works best for WAPUTA to come to one of our board meetings, have an opportunity to sit and listen. It's a listen meeting. To hear what your personal thoughts are about the effectiveness of WAPUTA and how we can do better, provide greater value to each of the PUDs. So I just wanted to get that out on the radar screen, and you'll have follow-ups with Rebecca and Steve to work out a date, and also with Kirk. And Kirk, this is also an invitation for managers of your choosing to sit in and have give us some input as well.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Gary, if you want to, at any moment during the year, a travel companion when you're going to Ponderay County or Assotin County, don't hesitate to call on one of us. I'll put my name on the list. Yes.
Thank you, Randy. I'd even
visit Douglas County with you, for crying out loud.
How about Grant? I've already got my calendar tentatively put together, and I'm going to be doing this all the way through April. So
I believe you.
I will definitely be calling on you. Thank you.
You bet.
Good efforts, Gary. Okay. Other commission items? Okay, hearing none, follow-up on delegation of action items from previous board meetings.
Yeah, we've got a few of them here to update you on. First one was Justin Erickson was going to work with communications. This is all from the May 16th board meeting to inform customers about Lake Chelan lake levels, and you heard the update on that at the manager items and the information that John shared in terms of the media release as well as the radio information sessions. Justin also had one to gather information on chemicals used in the de-icer for the Confluence Parkway, which you heard an update on today as well. And then another item from the May 16th meeting was that Eric was going to evaluate the rate schedule 36 calculation and adjustment methodology to the next scheduled energy charge adjustment period, which was towards December. And I want to point out that that was really mine. So we've reflected in the minutes that I took that one, as well as making clear the energy charge adjustment period was April 2023. So those minutes have been adjusted accordingly. And then we had a prior delegation of action item from another meeting. Eric was going to meet with Commission President and Vice President to review board governance policies to develop proposed edits for consideration, and that was completed late May.
Yeah, Commissioners, you should have that email with the draft attached in red line, and feel free to provide any feedback, and then we can coordinate with Commissioner McKenna and Rebecca the right time for adoption.
And I have a few of them for today on item number 20. So okay. I captured three, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I had one that Alex Dunn from Strategies 360 will review the customer survey data to see if he can filter out the renters with bills greater than $75 per month and assess the levels of satisfaction amongst that category of respondents. And Heather Ireland was going to come back with the budgets for the Rock Island and Rocky Reach facilities projects. And then I just added the third one, which was to schedule a time for the PUD Association to come to one of our board meetings.
Kurt, could I add one to that list that you just reminded me of?
Let's give it a shot.
That I didn't need to ask,
Dave. Let's give it a shot.
Okay, well, the question I really wanted to ask today about the survey methodology this morning was we're in a rapid transition in our society from landlines to cell phone lines. And do they track what percentage of their calls they make are cell versus land? And how does that track with what they know is the current usage, or do they know what the current usage is in our area? What percentage of people have landlines anymore?
I will add that one and see what we can find out there.
Okay.
Any others? Okay, thank you.
All right, at this time, I will again open it up to additional public comment. If we have anybody in the public that would like to address the commission, they can do so at this time. Rebecca, I'm not seeing anything here. Okay.
Ann has one.
Yep. Steve, I just want to jump in here and say a big thank you to Kelly, Aurora, and Karnan for joining our meeting.
Absolutely.
Love having you. I'm glad you guys are engaged and asking questions. Terrific.
Happy to be here.
Yes, likewise.
All right. Appreciate the willingness to serve. Do we have any other matters of general business as may necessarily come before the commission today? Particularly since I've been missing so many of them. So, okay. Don't see anything else. At this time, we will be recessing into executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or likely to become a party, and or legal risk, as authorized by RCW 42.3110, and to consider the minimum price at which real estate will be offered for sale or lease when public knowledge regarding such consideration could cause the likelihood of decreased price, as authorized by RCW 42.30.110. And we'll be doing that, Kirk, for 60 minutes.
Yes, at the risk of blowing all my credibility on estimates, I'll shoot for 60 minutes.
Okay, so we are in recess at this time, and we will resume in 60 minutes.
You want to take a 5 minute?
We are coming out of executive session. It is Monday, June 6, 2022. No decisions were made. No votes were taken. Is there any additional business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we stand adjourned.